I've received some information. There are some members who will be joining us. They are late due to traffic. And then I suggest that we start. Yesterday, when we attend, we were barely starting about chapter 2. And I just want to find out, Mr. Peter, from your side, whether are there any comments that you people want to make insofar as the thinking that we covered yesterday, the definition. If the department is not right about it, we can we just continue where we left yesterday.
Thank you, Chair. The committee requested us to have a look and try and bring today to this committee examples of other countries, especially the offences in their anti-trafficking legislation and definitions. We have prepared a document. I think it has been made available where some of the countries that we've managed to get hold of the legislation, and we've set it out in a document. We had enormous problems yesterday not being in our own offices with connectivity and trying to get into the internet so that we could download the stuff. And this is what we've managed to obtain. And you'll see the US legislation right on the last page. Connectivity failed and we weren't able to get back into the site for purposes of downloading it, but we will make that available. And when we are back in the office, we've got the tools all readily at our disposal, and we'll add to the document that we have submitted today for purposes of the information of the committee. We also started having a look at some of the issues that were raised in terms of the definitions, and we're preparing a document. The committee gave an indication that we didn't have to come back today on those particular issues, but we are in the process of doing that. And once we're back in our offices, then what I would suggest is, if the committee agrees, we will finalise that in the next day or two and submit it to the committee clerk and ask him to circulate it to two members.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Any comment before I say we proceed? Honourable Jeffrey.
Chair, I think it would be useful if the officials could take us through this document in terms of what are their recommendations, and then also really where did the definition that you've got in the Law Commission report come from? But I think it would be useful if we just get an explanation on that. Because just briefly looking at it now, Zambia looks a lot simpler.
Chair, can I just give a bit of background before I ask Ms. Stierman to talk about the Law Commission? The Law Commission report, and if I remember correctly, our original bill, the department's original bill, was based largely on the Law Commission report. Before we introduced the bill into Parliament, I'd just like to talk very briefly about the process. We obtained Cabinet approval to submit the bill again for comments, and we did it on a large scale. The bill was published in the Gazette and for public comments. And during that process, we received quite a bit of comments. And that gave rise to change some of the changes to our original bill, which was basically the Law Commission bill. And that is the bill that we took to Cabinet with the adaptations as a result of public comments. And then naturally after it was approved by Cabinet for introduction, it went to the State Law Advisors, and there it underwent some changes as well. So I just want to make the point that our bill originally was based largely on the Law Commission report, and changes that came subsequent to that were as a result of mostly comments that we received from the public at large. On the definitions and that are in the bill now, they have been consulted on, and I think there was quite widespread approval for the approach that was originally in the bill, and some of the main role players, for instance, the NPA, they are comfortable with that, with the approach taken there. I do hear that there are calls for simplification, and that we can possibly do that, but all the definitions that are in there, debt bondage and slavery and servitude and exploitation and sexual exploitation, were largely agreed to, as I said yesterday, mainly because we're sitting with a new type of offence, a new offence completely trafficking, and it was felt that there really is a need to have these definitions to guide the prosecution and to guide the courts. So that's why the approach that is in the bill as far as these aspects are concerned are there. Thank you. But I'll hand over to Mr. Yuman.
Just before, Mr. Yuman. Thanks, Honorable Schaefer. I did receive the report that you will be a little bit late due to the traffic. Thank you. You can...
Thank you, Chair. Just regarding the definition of trafficking in persons as contained in the Law Reform Commission's report, we have used the Palermo Protocol as the basis for drafting the definition on trafficking. But what we have also done, we have consulted on the bill contained in the bill that contained in the definitions report over a period of years, about 3 or more years. And during our consultative process on the bill, people actually felt that a lot of terms is provided for in the definition of trafficking contained in the Palermo Protocol is not very clear, and that we actually need to go much broader in this bill in order to make some of the terms much more clear. For example, the Palermo Protocol talks about servitude, and there were calls that let's have a definition for servitude, because how are we actually going to understand what servitude means? The same with the definition of exploitation, where you would include something under the definition of exploitation, then the question arises again, but what does forced marriage mean? And for those reasons, we actually went further to define what's included in the definition of trafficking, the definition and as well as the definition of exploitation. Thanks.
Right. Then let us proceed from...
Can I then take you through this document that we provided you with?
Yes.
Within the limited time that we had, we have done a comparative study on the definition of trafficking in persons and the related definition, as well as the offence of trafficking in persons in 3 African countries, Zambia, Mozambique, and Kenya. We've also looked at some of the developed countries, which, similar to South Africa, also mainly serves as country of destination for victims of trafficking. And that is Australia, the UK, and the US. Getting to Zambia, the issue of trafficking in persons is dealt with in the Anti-Human Trafficking Act. They have a definition of traffic, and this definition of traffic is very similar to the definition of trafficking as contained in the Palermo Protocol, except for paragraph D and paragraph E. Paragraph D deals with false or illegal adoption of a child, and E deals with the destruction, concealment, removal, confiscation, or possession, it should be possession, I think, of any passport, immigration document, or other official identification document. So the definition of traffic is not as broad as the definition that we have as contained in the bill. You will see the definition of traffic ends with "for the purpose of exploitation." And then they went further and they defined exploitation. The definition of exploitation looks very similar to the definition of exploitation that we have contained in our bill, but what you will also notice that under the definition of exploitation, unlike the bill that we have, they did not include debt bondage. The definition of exploitation under B also talks about sexual exploitation. So they went further and they defined sexual exploitation. And the definition of sexual exploitation actually is almost similar to the last part of the definition of sexual exploitation that we have in our bill. Then they also have an offense of trafficking. They first criminalize the act of trafficking, and the rest of their provision actually provides for different penalties for different forms of trafficking. And they also have, you will also notice that I have minimum sentences actually, which states that, for example, imprisonment for a term of not less than 25 years may be imposed. So they actually got very high penalties as provided for in that clause. The Mozambican law, if you look at the definition of human trafficking, that definition is actually not very clear. And I'm not sure is it because of the fact that I had to translate it from Portuguese to English. But if one actually reads it, it's very confusing. Then they also have an offense of human trafficking.
Doing the translation yourself?
No, I wish I could have, but this was we've received it from the UNODC. They also have an offense of human trafficking. And you will see the second line reads as follows, including under the pretext of domestic or overseas employment or trafficking or education, except for those words. The rest of the words are exactly the same as contained in the Palermo Protocol. Then we come to Kenya, which is very interesting about Kenya is that they do not have a definition of, actually, if you look at a definition of trafficking, they refer you to the offenses clause in 3. Trafficking in persons has the meaning assigned to it by section 3. And if you go to the offenses section on the next page, the offenses section is very similar to section 3.1. It's very similar to the wording as contained in the Palermo Protocol, except for paragraph F, which reads, giving payment or benefits to obtain the consent of a victim of trafficking in persons. If you go back to page 3, you will see that I also have quite a comprehensive definition of exploitation. And it's also very much similar to the definition of exploitation that's contained in OLBO. And they also go further and define forced labor. They define slavery, and they also define trafficking for sexual exploitation. Going over to page 5 is, if one looks at Australian legislation dealing with trafficking, they do not define trafficking in persons, but what they actually have done, they've created different offences to deal with different kinds of scenarios that could constitute trafficking in persons. You will see on page 5 they have the offence of trafficking in persons, and that is further broken down. Going over to page 7, they have aggravated offence of trafficking in person. Then they have offence of trafficking in children. And then they also have offences relating to domestic trafficking in person, as well as aggravated offence of domestic trafficking in person. The problem with this is also that if you do not have a specific definition on trafficking in persons, then you actually have to go and provide for each and every possible scenario. But if you do have a comprehensive definition of trafficking, then one will actually have that freedom to work within the definition of trafficking. Going over to the United Kingdom, their legislation doesn't seem to be that comprehensive, and I couldn't find any definition of trafficking in the United Kingdom, but I do deal with trafficking under three pieces of legislation, which respectively deal with trafficking for purposes of sexual exploitation in terms of the Sexual Offences Act, and they also then deal with cross-border trafficking for all purposes of for all forms of trafficking in terms of the Asylum and Immigration Act, and then they also deal with trafficking for purposes of all forms of exploitation, slavery, servitude, and forced labor in terms of the Justice Act of 2009. The U.S. is also seem to have a problem with quite a number of persons being trafficked to the U.S. They actually defined trafficking as severe forms of trafficking, and they have a specific they define severe forms of trafficking to mean sex trafficking in which a commercial act is induced by force, fraud, or coercion, or in which the person induced to perform such act has not attained 18 years, and also to mean the recruitment, harboring, transportation, provision, or obtaining of a person for labor or services through the use of force, fraud, coercion for the purposes of subjection to involuntary servitude, punage, debt, bondage, or slavery. They also create specific offenses relating to trafficking in persons under two pieces of legislation, that is the Trafficking and Violence of Protection Act as well as the United States Code. Unfortunately, at this stage, I lost my internet connection and I could not really obtain the specific offences, but we will go back and provide you with this. This is basically what we could do within the time that we had to our disposal to do.
Thank you. Let us open it for the committee.
Chair, sorry to interrupt. If I may, there's a document that's just a one-pager that's been distributed. That's another, and it's only relating to the definition of trafficking. That's an earlier version of our definition of trafficking, and I thought if the committee would like to have a look at that.
Thank you. I now open it to the committee for any possible questions and comments. Professor?
Thank you, sir. Just a question based on process curiosity. Now, how do you determine the sample of places, U.S., Mozambique, etc., when you look at a particular section like trafficking? What makes you decide to go to this place and not other places? And how many countries did you consult to have a look at trafficking? Thank you.
Question from Honorable Schaefer.
It's not a question, just a comment, but I mean, obviously we haven't had a chance to really consider this properly, but on a cursory glancing, it would seem to me to be more, easier to really to go for something like the Zambian one, where it's clearly set out, instead of that whole Australian, where you've got to have three pages of different kinds of definitions. If you can maybe just give your opinion on that one.
Honorable Jeffrey.
I actually like the Kenyan one the best. I mean, I agree that the Australian one is I think a nightmare because you've got to then read through each one, find out which one you're which category you're in. The Kenyan one I was just also interested because it is 2010, so it's the most recent one. But I mean, Zambia's not too bad. That's 2008. But you see, what I like with the Kenyan one is a proper. You've got the definitions, but you've got on page 4 a proper crime, trafficking persons. Whereas in our bill, the crime is you're guilty of the offence of trafficking persons if you traffic a person, which, you know, is a bit of a, yeah, I mean, it, I don't, yeah, anyway, I don't know how to describe it. So, I see from the Law Commission, and by the way, I've only realized now, we never got this report from the Law Commission. I mean, I've just got this Mr. Bassett's copy, but it really, we need it. I mean, they did a lot of work. They had a more set out offense, which according to Mr. Bassett, then because of submissions, they changed it. Maybe he could, or somebody could explain what those submissions were. And then I think the last point is, you know, the people I'd really like to hear from on the definition and on the offense would be the NPA, because they're prosecuting. So you'd want to know, okay, from the cases that they've dealt with, if they had a better definition, where did it fall down? So Mr. Bassett said in his input that they were comfortable with the way the bill is worded at the moment. I would have preferred the word happy. I'd want to know they were happy. I think they should be giving the lead, because they're the ones who have to prosecute. And I mean, it's clear that the definition is very difficult. You've got, I noticed, some countries, you know, trafficking includes the following, so it's a completely open list. Others are then, it's a closed list. Trafficking is. I can see the desire to have open lists, but it makes it more confusing. So really, in short, I think what I'm saying is I do like the idea of setting out a crime, which is what the Law Commission, to some extent, did originally in the bill. Why was it changed? I mean, rather than what were the sort of submissions that caused it to be changed? And then I think that it would be useful to hear from the NPA what it would their preferred definition be, and rather than a situation where they're comfortable. I'd like them to be more than comfortable.
Responses,
thank you, Chair. Just responding to the first question as to how did we go about on deciding on the different countries. I think, firstly, given the fact that we're part of Africa, we've looked at, you know, all those countries that actually have trafficking legislation in place or are in the process of drafting trafficking legislation. And with regard to some of the developed countries, we basically also looked at those countries which have similar problems, like South Africa, because currently South Africa is mainly a country of destination, but also serves as a country of transit as well as a country of resource. That's why we've also looked at those countries that actually drafted legislation, or where they actually had legislation for quite a number of years and had several prosecutions under those legislation. I think I also agree with you if you say that an Australian the Australian Act, the way they set it out, it's really a nightmare, because you will actually have to go and look at every eventuality. The Zambian bill looks more similar to what we have, but I hear that Honourable Jeffrey seems to be in favour of what is provided for in the Kenyan legislation, but I would also just like to get guidance on the fact that the Kenyan ones actually refer back to the offence of trafficking instead of having a definition on trafficking, and if we should go this way, how do we deal with it? Just want to say with regard to the NPA, what the Sexual Offences and Community Affairs Unit actually did, they sent out an email to all the prosecutors which, you know, those, especially those prosecutors that have dealt with trafficking cases before, to just to get an opinion as to whether they feel comfortable with the bill, particularly the offense of trafficking as well as the definition of trafficking and the other offenses provided for. Actually, all of the submissions that we've received say that they're fairly happy with it, but I'm not sure whether they actually apply their mind to it. So I think there's a need to really go back to the NPA and just highlight the concerns of the committee and just see how to go about this again. With regard to the question on what kind of submissions were received by the department, which resulted in the definition and some of the offences to be changed, I'm not really in a position to answer it now. I think I will have to go back and just look at those submissions again, and then one can reply to the committee at a later stage.
Shall we then leave the portion of definitions and proceed from where we left yesterday?
Going. I mean, obviously, we need to apply our minds more. I think it would be useful to have somebody from the NPA who's prosecuting. Who's been prosecuting these cases? I don't know if there are any in the Western Cape. And then I think ultimately it's the thing of, are you guilty of the offence of trafficking if you traffic, which is effectively what we've got in the bill, or do we set out what the crime is? And I think it's both an issue of what makes it easier for, well, I think first prize is the definition has to be, the first requirement or the first priority is that the crime is prosecutable, okay, that you've got the best definition in order to prosecute trafficking cases. That's the first prize. The second requirement, but not as important as the first, was that it's understandable. But the most important thing is that we come up with a definition of the crime that makes it easier to prosecute and convict people involved in trafficking. Now I don't know. I mean I've generally got a as an individual an inherent preference towards the Kenyan model, which doesn't define trafficking. Does have other definitions of exploitation, forced labor, etc., trafficking and so on, but it creates the crime in the body. But I don't know what other people feel, and I'm not going to die in the trenches. And as I said, the key thing for me is that we want a definition that ensures that those people who have committed the crime of trafficking, however that is defined, but those people who in the ordinary sense of the word are traffickers or involved in trafficking get convicted, get prosecuted and convicted. And so, as I said, that's where the NPA thing, I think, for me comes in. That in a sense, we should be saying to them, write what you give us the definition of the crime.
Professor?
Honourable Chair, I'm inclined to agree with the Honourable Chair because I think the elements of the crime are very, very important. Armed with the elements of the crime of trafficking, then the prosecutor or the NPA will be able to deal with the crime in a more efficient way. So I support the Honourable Chair.
Honourable
Stefan.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yes, I think that's a very valid point, and I think it would be very useful for the NPA to come and explain to us how they would be able, you know, do they foresee being able to prosecute, and if not, what are the problem areas that they foresee as far as proof is concerned, and if some elements perhaps missing that we should include here. And I agree that it's rather strange to have a definition, you know, an offence of trafficking is if you traffic. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, trafficking is defined, but traffic isn't actually. So then you maybe need to put in a definition of traffic as well. But I don't think that really assists. We need to know exactly what it means.
There was some mention of Western Cape, NPA Western Cape. What is the likelihood of getting someone from this province on the office of the NPA?
I wonder if Ms. Advocate Tessie wouldn't be available. I think she's more in a managerial position, but I would like to think she's pretty clued up.
Yeah, I think let's leave it open to the NPA. I mean, I was just raising Western Cape from a point of view of saving money. But if, for example, they feel most of their trafficking cases are in Gauteng, then it would be better. But it would be good to see a practitioner. I think really what we should be saying to the NPA is, look, give us your, I don't know if they've done it already in submissions, give us your preferred crime of trafficking written down, and then come and talk to us about it.
I get a sense, and just like guidance on this, perhaps we should look seriously at the Kenyan model, and then take that to the NPA and a few other alternatives. I can just mention an earlier version of our bill. I think it's more in line with what the committee wanted, but doesn't go far enough. Trafficking person is originally read, any person intentionally traffics another person is guilty of the offence of trafficking person. So they'll be starting it, but we haven't gone the entire route that the Kenyans have gone. So perhaps we can have a look at the Kenyan model as basis and take that to the NPA and ask them to comment on that and any other thing they'd like to say.
And Chair, through you, I mean, maybe just to find out a bit more about the Kenyan one. I mean, what I, apart from more generally liking it, it is the most recent one, 2010, according to this. So, you know, how long did they spend on it? Where did it come from? What did they do? Maybe to try and contact somebody from the Kenyan Parliament, just to find out more on it. And then how is, I don't know if it's been implemented yet. Yeah.
Right, you can proceed there.
Are we proceeding now with the provisions as contained in the bill?
Someone was asked to spend some time on the definition. I suggest that we proceed from where we left it.
Thank you, Chair. We actually started clause 4. And yes, I will then take you now from clause 4 in the bill. You will see clause 4 criminalizes trafficking. It also makes trafficking subject to the Minimum Sentencing Act, which means that a high court or a regional court would be able to impose a term of imprisonment of up to life. If you go over to subclause 2, it creates the offence of involvement in trafficking in persons. Just to mention, the Sexual Offences Act also contains an offence of involvement in trafficking in persons. You will also see subsection 2 is also subject to the Minimum Sentencing Act, which actually means that before I get to this point, let me first refer you to paragraph A, B, and C of subsection 2. These offences, except for the ones that I'm going to read in paragraph B, directs, aids, promotes, advises, recruits, encourages, except for those words, A to C is very similar or exactly the same as provided for in the Riotous Section 18 of the Riotous Assemblies Act. So it's more or less a duplication there. And the question is whether one should actually include it there or perhaps just have a separate offence on paragraph B dealing with those words that I said are not covered in terms of the Riotous Assemblies Act. If one also look at subsection 2, having made this subject to the Minimum Sentencing Act, this actually means that for an attempt of trafficking in persons or an attempt of death bondage, one would be able to impose a period of imprisonment of up to life. But if you go and look at the actual offences in the bill, for example, death bondage has a term of imprisonment of up to 15 years. So it doesn't make sense to have death bondage. You have a sentence of 15 years for the actual offence, and for an attempt to commit the offence, you can have imprisonment for up to life. So one will also just have to look at that. Subclause 3 provides that a child victim, it's not a defense to contravening subsection 1 or 2 to state that a child has consented to the intended exploitation, or that a person who had control or authority over the child has consented to the intended exploitation. Also, with regard to adult victims of trafficking, it's not enough defense to say that an adult person consented to the intended exploitation, except if one or the other of the means as provided for in the definition is not present. Subclause 4 deals with liability of an employer and basically states that a conduct of an employee or agent or other person acting on behalf of that employer or principal may be attributed to the employer or principal if that person is acting within the scope of his employment, within the scope of his or her actual apparent authority, and with the express or implied consent of the director, member, or partner of the employer. And subsection 5 goes further to say that subsection 4 does not exclude the liability of an employee or agent or for any other person acting on behalf of the employer or principal for committing the offence of trafficking in persons. Perhaps I should just pause there for possible questions.
Questions or comments on this section? Yes, Honourable Jay, Jeffrey.
I know you mentioned it yesterday and I never asked you, but why is this reference to the Righteous Assemblies Act? I'm just a little bit uncomfortable with what I imagine was an act designed to stop legitimate popular protest against a crime against humanity being used. So why are you using that? I note, and you know, it's very wide, but is it not too wide to become, and now talking about clause 2, obviously with clause 1 we're going to be looking at with the Kenyan model and everything else, the actual crime. So I'm more focusing on one is this, if you traffic, you've committed a crime of trafficking if you traffic. Two is then the aiding and the abetting one. Kenya is you've got then from the Righteous Assemblies Act incites, instigates, commands, directs, aids, promotes, advises, recruits, encourages, or procures. So it's basically everything, but it might be valid stuff that the apartheid regime wanted to get people who had organized the gathering. But is it really applicable to trafficking, which is a specific organized act? And then looking at the Kenyan one, which is on page 4, 3, sub 6, there they've got it more limited, and that's finances, controls, aids, or bets. The commission of an offense under subsection 1, the trafficking. Is that not sufficient? Because inciting trafficking, why does that need, I mean, is that going to happen? You know, what you want to do with this section is you want to catch the people who supported it, aided and abetted, to my mind, gave the money, whatever part of it. But do people go in and fight trafficking? It's a question. I don't know, but I can't really quite imagine the situation. Or instigate trafficking. You instigate a gathering, a riot, as the apartheid regime was worried about. But do you instigate trafficking? Because trafficking has to be presumably carefully planned. You can't just sort of traffic someone. And then, are you going to have people commanding trafficking or directing trafficking? So I'm really just a bit surprised why you've made use of the Righteous Assembly. Maybe if you can just explain that, and then I to throw open to the committee the Kenyan wording of finance control, aid or abet, and is that not more appropriate for the accessory crime, really, effectively?
I'm not sure I'm entirely awake this morning. If you can just reiterate that that concern of yours about the minimum sentence, because, I mean, I thought I understood you, but now 4.1 says, you also say the minimum sentencing is applying. So it's not that that's not applying there. Yeah, it applies to one as well. So it's not only applying to attempts or involvement instead of the actual offense. It applies to both. So are you saying you think that's too harsh for number two? If you can just clarify this.
Thank you, Chair. I think I'm going to need assistance of the state law advisor with regard to the first question. Because subsection 2 was included by the state law advisors here. But I would also like to refer you to the protocol. If you go and look at page 39 of the protocol under Article 5, Article 5.2, it states that each state party shall adopt such legislative or other measures as may be necessary to establish as criminal offences, and then it goes over to, you will see in B, it speaks about participating as an accomplice, and in C, it talks about organising or directing other persons to commit an offence of trafficking in persons. We already have an offence of attempt in our law. We already have offences dealing with participating as an accomplice, so there's no need for repeating it in the trafficking bill. But currently, we do not have anything that covers paragraph C. So if we do delete, for example, subsection 2, then we will still have to look at what is being requested by Article 5, paragraph C of the trafficking protocol.
Sorry, can I just say, you've misunderstood me entirely. I'm not saying delete 2. I'm questioning, though, the wording and then why you seem to have taken it from the Righteous Assemblies Act, and then is the, is the other wording not more simplified? You know, as I said, the Kenyan one, which is finance control, aid or abet.
You know, what I actually think, and I think this is also perhaps the reason why the state law advisor decided to include it here, because the Sexual Offences Amendment Act actually adopted the wording of the Righteous Assemblies Act, and they have a similar provision contained in the Sexual Offences Act. But if one actually looks at this, I don't see any need for it being here, because these are already covered in terms of the Righteous Assemblies Act.
Sorry, what's the relevance of an act dealing with gatherings for trafficking? It may well be in the Sexual Offences Act, I don't know, but we're dealing with, we're making law here now, and I want to know what's the relevance of using the Righteous Assemblies Act? Because you can sort of understand with the incite, instigate, thing that the people wanting to nail people for supposedly being involved in organizing events wanted to spread the net so wide, and gatherings can just happen. So you want to sort of get that. But trafficking surely is a lot more organized. So how do you incite trafficking? How do you instigate trafficking? What do you, what crime are you trying to cover? Yeah, command.
It actually doesn't seem to be relevant to the offense of trafficking if you actually looked at it. And I was actually just explaining the reason why this is actually here, but if you actually analyze it, it doesn't really seem to be relevant to the crime of trafficking.
Do you want to say something? I think
Louisa's covered part of it. What Louisa's trying to convey is we might not need to put anything about aiding, abetting, attempts and all those sort of things, because coincidentally, and it's unfortunate that it has a bearing, it is that particular piece of legislation, 1956 piece of legislation that was enacted for the purposes that Mr. Jeffrey was talking about, that it, the wording is such that you don't really need to talk about attempts or aiding, abetting, because that's already dealt with in terms of the law, that act. And I'm just trying to get into Judas that I'll read what it says. It basically says that a person that commits a statutory offense, or a person can be punished for the statutory offense if he's committed it, but has attempted to commit it or instigated or commanded. And then there's another provision in the Criminal Procedure Act, and I don't have it here, and I'll try and get into it as well, that I think also deals with attempts. So I think what Louise is saying is, you know, the question arises, do we actually need to have a provision, a subsection 2? We need to just go back and have a look at the Kenyan model again and at the protocol to see what is not in the Criminal Procedure Act or not in the Riotous Assemblies Act so that we have it here. So I don't think there's any harm in putting it here, but the Criminal Procedure Act, if we can fall back on the Criminal Procedure Act, would be a better bet, because you're liable for the punishment of the actual offence, even though it's only attempt.
I'm not against two, because my fear is that most of the crimes that would be covered, that are crimes, are more like sort of single events. So you can be charged as an accessory to murder. The issue was killing this person. Accessory to robbery, maybe robberies are more complicated, but you participated. Whereas trafficking for me would be a much longer chain, because it does involve a movement of people. And so for me, it inherently makes sense to cover people who were involved in that chain, the recruitment, the things like that, and that the normal law regarding being an accessory may not apply, or it might be necessary to tighten it. So that's why I'm not against two. It's just a question of the wording. But as I said, my fear to Mr. Bassett, my fear is that if we don't have something, given that the trafficking is a drawn-out process, a longer drawn-out process than most other crimes, don't we need specific wording to cover the participation, the aiding in that crime?
Thanks. I was just wondering whether it might be enough to take B and C out and just say if that person performs any act aimed at committing an offence under this chapter. Surely that would also cover attempts and instigation or whatever else it might be. I mean, if they do anything that is aimed at committing an offence, then would that not cover it?
It's already covered in other legislation. We already have it, attempt. Just to respond to the previous question, you've requested whether, just to explain again to you my concern regarding the minimum sentences in subclause 2. If one reads subclause 2, it's subject to the Minimum Sentencing Act, which means that a sentence of life imprisonment could be imposed. Let's just take paragraph A. A person who performs any act aimed at committing an offence, take, for example, death bondage. That person a period of imprisonment, of life imprisonment, can then be imposed on that person. But let's go to the actual offense of death bondage. The actual offense of death bondage states that a period of imprisonment, not more than 15 years, may be imposed. So for the actual offense, you're liable for a lesser period of imprisonment. But for an attempt to commit that offense, you can get life.
Where is that 15 years suspension?
Just look at the offense of death bondage on page 8. Because subsection 2 covers all the other offenses except the offense of trafficking.
Honorable Chief, when you were explaining the instigation and the command, you bring back my thoughts when people were complaining about the wide explanation of the laws in the past, which resulted in the common people's people on a light note ended saying that sometimes you get arrested for the Kristen and cake.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, we can proceed.
Just a note, I gather, and I mean the document hasn't been submitted yet, but from an NPA document, that the fines that people seem to get seem to be rather light, or the punishments, so minimum sentences is not necessarily that bad, but I just sort of see it's fines and suspended sentences for trafficking, which I don't think is appropriate, but anyway. But anyway, I think the NPA will present on that when they come. But just going back to this question, and given the coverage by other laws, but financing, you see, I would, and maybe it's covered elsewhere, I would quite like, okay, you've got the liability of carriers. I would probably like some kind of strict liability for people involved in the financing of trafficking. Strict liability in the sense of the you don't have to prove intention, you know, that they ought to have known or they should have known. So I'm just raising the financing question. Is that covered by existing law? You know, a person, because trafficking involves transportation generally, you know, so maybe people are trafficked into the country through a road haulage vehicle. Now, the person paying for that vehicle, you want to be able to try and nail them and by saying they should have known what was happening. And in a sense, almost puts more duty if people are involved in the transportation stuff. We can come onto it when we get onto carriers. A duty to actually check what's going on with your carriers. So maybe it's under carriers, but the financing thing, I just wonder whether that is covered by existing law, and shouldn't it be? And shouldn't we then also maybe be looking at more strict liability when it comes to things like financing?
Thank you, Chair. We can deal with those issues once we get to clause 9. With regard to the rest of the offences, starting from death bondage until the end of the chapter, the submissions that we've received actually stated that the penalties are too lenient and the penalties need to be increased. Some of them also said that we need to provide for minimum sentences apart from the offence of trafficking, that the rest of the offences provided for in Chapter 3 should also be subject to minimum sentences. We have discussed this over the NPA, and the NPA's preliminary view, and I assume they will also then highlight it to you once they brief the committee, is that they're not in favour of minimum sentences in respect of the rest of the provisions as contained in the bill, except for the offence of trafficking. And I would actually just like to read something to you that was published on the 1st of November, 1st of November in the legal briefs. as well as one of the local newspapers. It reads as follows: Correctional Services Inspecting Judge Dion van Sail said that minimum sentencing legislation was putting a huge strain on overfull correctional centers, with life and long-term prisoners increasing by 572% in the past decade. He further said that minimum sentencing legislation curbs and limits the discretion of judicial officers and is also causing prisons to be filled. And the recommendation from Judge Van Sail is that detailed research needs to be conducted into the effect of long-term sentences on cost, overcrowding, and activities of prison gangs. That was just a sideline comment that I wanted to read to you. Coming to the definition of death bondage, not the definition of death bondage, the clause of death bondage, it provides that a person who intentionally engages in conduct that causes another person to enter into death bondage is guilty of an offense and is liable on conviction to a fine or imprisonment for a period not exceeding 15 years. Here we have a maximum penalty and not a minimum penalty. And for the rest of the offenses, we also have a maximum penalty and not minimum penalty.
I think it might well be worth taking out just subject to the minimum sentencing in paragraph 2, because it doesn't make sense. It contradicts the other clauses, and it does, you know, I mean, there are cases where that could be justified, and if we leave it just for the offence of trafficking, surely that would be satisfactory and leave the rest up to the discretion of the judicial officers, because at the moment we're curbing the discretion left, right and centre.
I'm not particularly in favour of minimum sentencing, but just as Judge Fonseil's comments, I don't agree with. I mean, really, he's got no... I mean, one, he's the inspecting judge for prisons, so he's concerned about the prisons being too full. Well, maybe more prisons should be built. As far as curbing the judicial discretion, well... The minimum sentencing has been subjected to numerous court challenges, including the Constitutional Court. It's valid, okay? So the judges shouldn't moan about that. And then, I think the difficulty is, and it's maybe something we should get from the NPA, but you know, here's a case of three Thai women, okay, trafficked here for prostitution. And it was other Thai men who were found guilty, and guess what their sentence is? I mean, would somebody like to have a guess? 2,000 rand final, 6 months suspended. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, there you traffic women from another country into our country for sex work, and you walk out with 2,000 or 6 months imprisonment, wholly suspended on 5 years on condition you're not found guilty again. So the problem is for me, those kinds of sentences mean, I don't know what court it was in, whether it was a match court or a regional court or what, but those kinds of sentences then basically say, look, there's something wrong in the minds of some of the judicial officers, and it becomes an argument. But I think it's something that let's get these stats properly from the NPA, and they should also be asked not just on the crime, but on the issue of sentencing.
Going over to Clause 6, Clause 6 provides that any person who has in his or her possession or intentionally destroys, confiscates, conceals, or tampers with any actual or purported identification document, passport, or other travel document of a victim of trafficking in facilitating or promoting trafficking in persons is guilty of an offence and liable on conviction to a fine or imprisonment for a period not exceeding 10 years. And on this clause, we haven't received any particular submission.
question.
Thanks. I just want, as a matter of interest, I mean, I don't have a major view on it, but what makes you decide on these 10 years here and 15 years there, and, you know, what makes you think one thing's more serious than the other?
Well, these are some of the suggestions that we got during our consultative processes. It was actually much lesser than what is currently stated, but from the submissions that we've received, they actually suggested that it need to be increased, and based on those submissions...
I'm not saying necessarily the number, but why 15 years here and 10 years there? That's the difference. I mean, what makes you get to that?
The difference between the actual trafficking and as defined with the one who is just found guilty of
No. I mean, just for example, on 5, 6, and 7, debt bondage, they say not exceeding 15 years, but then possession of documents or destruction of documents, 10 years, and then 7, using services of victims, 15 years. I don't understand why they're saying 15 sometimes and 10 other times.
I think it's up to us. I mean, they've made a value judgment around the seriousness, and I think the issue is debt bondage is quite heavy. I mean, you're causing somebody to basically work. I mean, I've just checked again the definition of debt bondage. You're causing somebody to work to pay off a debt where that debt is excessive, and basically that. So it's not just saying to somebody, okay, you owe me 1,000 rand, you must work then 5 hours for me. A lot wider than that. So that's quite heavy. Possession of documents or tampering with documents isn't as heavy. And then using the services of a sex worker who's been trafficked is heavy. But remember, these are the maximum fines, not the minimums. And the way the courts are going, it would be you give me your wrist, sort of slap, you encourage somebody to go into debt bondage.
Going over to clause 7, this clause was included here to deal with the issue of demand, and basically makes it a criminal offence to use the services of victims of trafficking, and any person who intentionally benefits financially or otherwise from the services of a victim of trafficking or uses or enables another person's use of the services of a victim of trafficking and knows or ought reasonably to have known that such person is a victim of trafficking, is guilty of an offence and is liable on conviction to a fine or imprisonment for a period not exceeding 15 years. The submissions on this clause was once again just that we need to increase the penalties. But other than that, people seem to be happy with the formulation of this provision.
Honorable Amorosin is not here. He would have said a massage parlor who is using a victim of the trafficking should be sentenced for 50 years. Okay. All right, you can continue. We have noted the differences in the recommendation as so far as sentences are concerned.
Going over to clause 8. Clause 8 states that a person is guilty of an offence and is liable on conviction to a fine or imprisonment for a period not exceeding 10 years if that person intentionally leases or subleases any room, house, building or establishment for facilitating or promoting trafficking in persons or allows it to be used or ought reasonably to have known that it will be used for facilitating or promoting trafficking in persons. On paragraph A, the Institute for Security Studies was actually concerned because they felt that this clause actually requires from an owner who leases out his property to actually investigate whether this person is involved in any activities relating to trafficking. But this is actually not what this clause requires. It does not place an obligation on anyone to investigate whether or not the person who is actually renting his or her place is involved in trafficking. Paragraph B also deals with, also makes it a criminal offence for any person who advertises, publish, print, broadcast, distribute, or causes the advertisement, publication, printing or broadcast or distribution of information that facilitates or promotes trafficking in persons by any means, including the internet or other information technology, and knows or reasonably or ought reasonably to have known that it will be used for facilitating or promoting trafficking in persons. Subclause 2 deals with the obligations on internet service providers. You will notice that subclause 2 does not place an obligation on an internet service provider to monitor the information on their service, but only if they do come across such information that they have an obligation to report it. And subclause 2 is very similar to what is currently provided for in the Films and Publications Act. Subclause 3 also have a penalty for internet service providers who fail to comply with these provisions. And subclause 4 basically deals with the revocation and cancellation of a license of such an internet service provider who contravenes the specific provisions.
Comments and questions by the committee. Section 8. Teddy, questions or comments? Can I just ask the SANEF, for example, that didn't make any submission in so far as that 8B, 81D, where it talks about the person who causes the publication, the printing, etc., etc.?
No, Chairperson, we didn't receive any submission from them.
Honourable Schaefer.
Thanks. Can I just ask if we had any submissions? Hang on. Sorry. Have we had any input from service providers as to whether this is in order or whether they've got any concerns about it?
No. No, we didn't.
I've noted the Honourable Jeffrey. Yes.
Thank you, Chief. In paragraph 81B, I see that person must know or ought reasonably to have known that the that will be used for facilitating or promoting trafficking in persons. Now my understanding is that any facility, I mean, facilities that may be used for trafficking can also be used for other legitimate business. Now, what are you to do to prevent that happening? If you have to advertise your facilities for legitimate business and somebody decides to use it for trafficking, will you be excused and not be found liable? Because you would know, obviously, that it could be used for that, but that is not what you are advertising it for. What happens in such a situation?
Right. That was Jeffrey.
Yeah, mine is that, and looking at, I think it was the ISS Women's Legal Center submission, that H1A just the wording lease or allows it to be used or ought reasonably to have known that it will be used for facilitating. Now my worry is that starts with the commencement of the act of the lease. And that is quite difficult to know, okay, as has been said. What is easier to know, and it doesn't seem to be covered, is you've entered into a lease with this person. You then start getting reports that there's a whole lot of... Where was that one? There was a case of I can't remember now, that they were running a... They claimed they were running a language school for Chinese women, teaching them English. But anyway, you get this report. There's a whole lot of foreign women
hanging around and people are coming visiting at all hours. And you're the landlord, it gets reported to you. I can't see any basis here because you've got the word will. Ought to have known that it will be used for facilitating. It's not will or is being used. So is this? I don't think the situation is covered. And that's where on page 21 of the submissions, the new H1B that ISS and Women's Legal Center, which is subsequent to leasing or subletting any room, house, or establishment, that they deal with a before and an after, and I don't think you deal with the after, and I think that's a big gap.
Yeah, I don't think that is the case. I mean, if you say intentionally leases, I don't think it apply only to the fact when you sign the lease agreement. I mean, the lease is a continuing contract. So, I mean, if you're still leasing the property. So I would like the legal advisor's response as to whether they think it is covered. If it isn't, I agree with the concern that we should include it. But I don't think it necessarily means just because you're saying intentionally leases that it only applies to when you first sign the lease. I mean, I think you are still leasing the property on an ongoing basis.
My concern is the second part. Ought reasonably to have known that it will be used. So it's a future thing that you've got to know. And my worry is where you ought reasonably to have known that it is being used. And I don't. And it's the is being. Is that covered? And then if you look at this thing of ISS and Women's Legal Center have divided it into an A and B. Leases and then subsequent to the leasing, and it then covers it, because I think that subsequent to the leasing is where it's going to be easier to catch people. It's going to be very difficult to say, well, look, this guy came along and he wanted to lease a place, and how am I to know what he's doing? But you are going to find situations where people have leased the premises and you then start getting told that it's being used for trafficking. And I don't think it's my concern is not covered because you've got will be used.
I think it's Chairperson, just responding to the last concern, you're correct in saying that it's not covered, but I would like to refer you to the document that we provided to forward all the comments. Just look at page 20, the second paragraph, where we say that the department on page 20 supports the suggestion that a landlord who subsequent to leasing their premises become aware of the fact that the premises are being used for facilitating trafficking, that we should also cover that in terms of the bill. So we will look at formulating a specific provision in that regard. Sorry, thanks, Chair. Just to add to what Louise is saying is that I want to bring to answer the Honourable Jeffrey's question, Mr. Jeffrey. If you look at 8.1a, it says intentionally leases or subleases any room, house, building, or establishment for facilitating or promoting trafficking in person, or allows it to be used for all three spiritual notes. So allows it to be used, meaning as on a continuous basis. So whether it's subsequent to the lease or whatever.
Yes, that's where the reasonably to have known comes in. So you allow it to be used, but your house is being used for trafficking. How are you going to prove the mens rea? That's why you've got the ought reasonably to have known section. But the ought reasonably to have known is that it will be used, not that it is being used. And look, I think we're in agreement, and I think then let's see I don't think it's clear. I think let's see then, and as the Spearman has said, the department supports the suggestion. So let's see a draft of a clause. There is that one from ISS, their new H1B. I mean, I agree with your comments around they wanted protection for people who've made reports. I see your comments there. That's covered elsewhere in the bill. But look at something along the lines of H1B.
Thank you. Just with regarding the first question, you will see that we do state that if the person is actually going to print the information or advertise the information, if firstly knowledge is required, and secondly if that person ought reasonably to have known. But I think the difficulty that we also had with this provision is one can just go and look at the classifieds. And you look at all those advertisements at the back of the classifieds, then you ask yourself how many of those advertisements are actually cases of trafficking. And I think perhaps this is one of the provisions that one just actually really need to comply your mind to, because it can actually cover a lot of scenarios. And one don't want to create consequences that should not have been created. We will definitely look at this again, given the difficulties that have been expressed in respect of this. This is B, yes.
The will is knows or ought reasonably to have known that it will be used. Now, I've also got a problem with the will, because you could have a situation where you continue to publish or distribute, and that's then not covered. So just to highlight that. And then, given then we've got Clause 8, what is the point of Clause 4.2? Which is the one we were speaking about earlier, which is the accessory aspect. Is Clause 8 not really what we need, and therefore Clause 2, what's it called, Clause 4.2, becomes confusing? And if there's anything left out in 4.2, shouldn't it be put under Clause 8, because that's the conduct facilitating trafficking, which is the aiding and abetting?
The only thing that will be left out in Clause 4 is as stated in the Palermo Protocol dealing with organizing. And I agree with you, because the word organizing is not currently reflected in clause 4.2. But we need to reflect it in Clause 8, and I think it will also be better reading if one then rather cover those things that will fall along the wayside in Clause 8 and then delete it from Clause 4.2. Can I proceed? Okay. Going to Clause 9, I would like to take you to the document that we gave you yesterday with the department's amendments. Clause 9 starts on page 7. You will remember that during the public hearing submissions, several of those that made submissions recommended that this clause should also be applicable to carriers within the Republic and not only to cross-border carriers. And then one member of this committee made a suggestion that perhaps we should amend the heading to make it clear that it only deals with cross-border carriers. But there was also another recommendation that, because in terms of this clause, if a carrier if a victim of trafficking has the necessary documentation to enter South Africa, there's no further responsibility on that carrier. And one of the recommendations was also made that, but what if the victim's documentation are in order, should this carrier not have liability to actually report cases of trafficking if he or she knows that this is a victim of trafficking? So we actually amended clause, we've inserted a new clause 2 as well as a new clause 3. But in light of the new subsection 2 and the new subsection 3, we would like to recommend that we do not amend the heading as suggested. Subsection 2 reads as follows, and this is in addition to subclause 1. A subclause 2 reads, a carrier who, on reasonable grounds, suspects that any of its passengers is a victim of trafficking must immediately report their suspicion to a police official for investigation. And that will basically apply to both your cross-border carriers as well as your carriers within the Republic. So even though a carrier within the Republic will not require a person to have travel documents to move from one province to another province, if that person has reason to believe that he or she is transporting a victim of trafficking, there should be an obligation on that person to report there's a possible victim of trafficking in the carrier. Subclause 3 basically just deals with a liability, and it also, if a carrier fails to report such a suspicion, you will be liable to a conviction, on conviction to a fine or to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 17 years. 1 year.
Yeah, I just have a concern with this heading. I don't think it reflects the intention of the section. And I mean, my view is that a heading should reflect what the section actually says. And it's not only dealing with cross-border issues. So surely it would be better to say liability of carriers.
Clause 9.1, isn't it covered already? What is the situation? I mean, when you travel internationally, they're quite heavy about checking twice that you've got your passport and you've got your visa and everything like that. Now, so what exactly is the existing law? Is it a crime, or is it just that they then have to have the onus of transporting you back if the country you're traveling to won't let you in? And then my other issue is carrier. Now, you're on the plane, it's international, and there you're sitting next to you're coming into South Africa, you're sitting next to, you're flying from Hong Kong or whatever, and the lady you're sitting next to tells you that she's coming to, you know, do sex work. You suspect she's being trafficked, so you report it to the air hostess. Okay? Now, as far as I can see, air hostess, that's not covered. Air hostess is not covered by the definition of carrier. I mean, maybe it's an agent, but she's not an agent, she's an employee. So it's carrier includes a company, owner, agent, operator, lessor, driver, charterer, or master. Surely you should have the word employee, because let's take the air hostess. Is he or she, or air host, whatever, are they? They're not an agent because they're employed. An agent is somebody else. They're not the operator because that would be the captain. They're not the driver. So I think that under that definition, they've been left out. And shouldn't you then cover it by including employee under the definition of carrier?
Thank you, Chair. Just on the last one, we are going to revisit the whole definition of carrier as we discussed yesterday, and I think we'll most probably veer in the direction of using person. Yeah. Person or juristic person, and then person, I think. But anyway, we'll make sure that we covered it. I've made a note of that there. Thank you.
Just on that issue, I mean, I don't think that will solve the situation, though, in Clause 9.1, because, I mean, they're saying a carrier who brings a victim knowing that the victim of trafficking doesn't have passport, etc. So, I mean, that's not going to cover your example, then, because, I mean, they might say we suspect, but how will she know that they don't have valid passport?
Because you basically, the planes check you when you come in.
Are we concerned about the employee, the hostess?
I'm just concerned that she's not necessarily going to know. I mean, you might say, I think that person's being trafficked, but they even if you look at a passport, if it's a good falsification, they might not reasonably think that that's not a valid passport. So I'm just concerned that might not solve this particular issue. That's all. Maybe they can look at that when you're busy with your definition.
Chair, I was just wondering, Mr. Jeffrey raised the question of strict liability earlier, and I don't know whether we want to discuss it while we're discussing this clause.
Well, I think we should discuss it now, and I just want to caution on that, because the definition as it is could theoretically then make somebody strictly liable who has had their car stolen for the purposes of trafficking, I think. And you can comment on that, but I think that that could potentially be brought into this as an offence.
Just explain what, so that we're on the same page, strict liability is and the defences to strict liability.
Can we come back to you on that?
I thought it was basically an assumption that it was, you know, so you don't have to prove that you knew, it's assumed that you knew. Presumably, a defense is if you can prove that you didn't know, then you're off. So I think for me it would be a thing of surely I don't see a problem with 9-1 having strict liability, because they're meant to check, and they do check. Obviously with 2, I know that can't be, I mean, well, it's not covered anyway, it's a reasonable suspicion. So definitely that's not a clause for strict liability. I mean, there's already objections from lawyers for human rights, I see, for putting in 2, but you can't make 2 strict liability. But you could make 1. So nobody's answered my question, Chair, of what is the existing law. When the aircraft carrier allows you to get onto the plane without a passport because they haven't checked properly, what is they committed a crime, or are they just so strong about checking because they have to fly you back home?
It's definitely an offence in terms of the Immigration Act, but the Immigration Act only provides for an administrative fine not exceeding 10,000 rand. That's why we saw the need for including subclause 1, where you will actually have a much higher fine, and you will also be subject to possible imprisonment. So even though it's already covered to some extent in the Immigration Act, the provisions in the Immigration Act seems to be much more lenient if one actually has to bring it within the context of trafficking in persons. Hence the specific clause in 9-1.
Okay, thanks. I just thought of something else. 9 is creating crimes. That's fine. But then there's under 5 or whatever is the 3 that they're liable to pay for the expenses for the care, accommodation, transportation, and repatriation. So once they've been found guilty, they're then liable for this. Now, should we not make a distinction between the crime of knowing or ought to have known that you're transporting trafficked victims, in which case you've committed a crime, you've got to have guilt beyond reasonable doubt, all that, versus a slightly lighter onus where, and maybe you could even have, I don't know, strict liability is a bit pushing it a bit far, but basically where you haven't committed a crime, but you are liable for the care and repatriation. So what I'm basically saying is sorry for using, but anyway, it did happen. There were these Thai women. They've been found to have been trafficked. Okay, the police do their investigation, and they discover that they flew on SAA from Hong Kong. They were like Yeah, basically forcing SAA to pay for their, for, you know, that SAA, basically, what I'm trying to do is put a duty on the airline companies to actually be more, to look more, because not because they'll get found guilty of a crime, but because they're going to end up having to fly those women back to Thailand. I don't know if you see where I'm going, but I do think, so that's a bit of a waffle and a bit of a thinking from the top of my head, but I do think that the in terms of the act, that the payment for the repatriation should not be linked to being found guilty of the crime. There should be like in civil law, I mean, it's a balance of probabilities. So the test should be the civil one for being liable for looking after them and repatriating them. Whereas if you've linked, if you do it as you have now, linked to the criminal, then it's a quantum of proof of beyond reasonable doubt. It's much more difficult. I'm not sure if you're following that, but that's the problem I've got with the wording. The rest was a bit of a waffle, but it was also the point of if you do hurt the airlines financially, you may then make them more careful about who they're relying on their planes.
Okay, we will work on possible formulations. Can I just find out whether the committee agrees with the proposed sub clause 2 and sub clause 3?
The committee is saying, are we agreed about it?
The same document that you have before you, clause 11 dealing with factors to be considered in sentencing. You will notice that originally we have listed the factors that the court must take into account. Did I skip a clause? Oh, sorry. Clause 10, going back to the bill. Clause 10 basically deals with extraterritorial jurisdiction. As you know, the crime of trafficking in persons can start in one country, they can transit to another country, and the actual exploitation can actually take place in the third country. So your evidence will be all over the place. And that's why we've included the clause on extraterritorial jurisdiction. And the court in the Republic will have jurisdiction in respect of an act committed outside of the Republic, which would have constituted an offence in terms of this act had it been committed in the Republic, regardless of whether or not the act constitutes an offence at its place of commission. The court will have jurisdiction if the person to be charged is a citizen of South Africa, is a resident in the Republic, and has committed the offence against a citizen of the Republic or a person who is ordinary resident in the Republic. And clause D actually creates universal jurisdiction, which means that it doesn't, irrespective of where the crime was committed, against whom it was committed, or by whom it was committed, the High Court will have universal jurisdiction. It also creates jurisdiction if the person to be charged is not extradited from the Republic, and also if the person is a juristic person or a partnership registered in terms of any law in the Republic. Subclause 2 just makes it clear that in terms of paragraph A, only the High Court will have jurisdiction in that case. And this is also very similar to what is currently contained in the Sexual Offences Amendment Act.
Comment or question? part of the committee.
Chair, I'm trying to rest up yourself too. I think here we're talking about the perpetrator of the crime being a citizen of the Republic, ordinary resident, committing the offense against a citizen of the Republic. Must it be, who has to be a victim of this crime? Does it matter whether the person who the victim is a citizen of the Republic or not?
Like, for example, if a South African citizen is in Mozambique, and a citizen of Mozambique commits the offense of trafficking in persons against their South African citizen, merely because, or based on the fact that the offense was committed against the South African citizen, if that Mozambican national finds himself in South Africa, then our court will have jurisdiction to prosecute that national of Mozambique. So it creates within South Africa, but we can then also request that that person could be extradited to South Africa for purposes of facing prosecution in South Africa. So this will cover the situation where the perpetrator is a South African citizen, or even where the victim is a South African citizen.
Does it cover a situation where the perpetrator is a South African, but the victim is a Mozambican? And this occurs in Mozambique?
Yes. You will see it says that if the person to be charged is a citizen of the Republic, so if a South African citizen commits this offense against anyone in Mozambique, then we will have jurisdiction to prosecute that South African citizen. Yes.
Any further comments or questions? Yes, Ms. Thelma.
Can I proceed with Clause 11?
I think all of us needed it. Welcome, Honorable Squad. I did receive some reports from Wonani, that you may be joining us today. Right, Ms. Spielman, you can proceed.
Thank you, Chair. Starting from Clause 11.
If you covered it, I was out of it at the end, but Clause 10, Sub 5. You can't institute a prosecution against a person with respect to conduct which form the basis of an offence under this Act in respect of that which person has already been convicted or acquitted by a court of another country's jurisdiction. I mean, that's basically, I suppose, the Ostrafa Aki doctrine, that you base it on conduct. So my reading, if it's correct, is that you got charged with tax evasion in another country for smuggling, for running a brothel with trafficked women, and you got acquitted. Now you can't be charged, you're South African, you can't be charged in South Africa because the conduct is the same. So do you see that? So although obviously Ostrafa Aki, or how you pronounce it, Aki. Okay, well, it's the... okay. Although the doctrine of that you can't be tried twice for the same offence is something that needs to be recognised. Double jeopardy, okay. Do we need five? Because if a person is charged, you see, I want to avoid a situation where they get the same course of events, the trafficking, but in the other country they get charged with something minor. And because the systems are not that good, they get acquitted. And now because of five, South Africa is precluded from charging them. Do you need it, because effectively if they do get charged, they will raise it as a defense, and then the court can look at it on a case-by-case basis. So I'm maybe if you can just explain to us a bit more about five, and is five necessary? Because, as I said, I don't like the... Also, the double jeopardy can't be charged twice. I thought it was the actual offence, not the code of not the course of conduct.
I mean, as you highlighted, in any event, the court would not be able to prosecute if the person was already prosecuted for the offence in that country.
This is not the offence, this is the conduct.
I see what you mean. It refers to the conduct. It's either removing that whole subsection or then only refer to the offence and not to conduct which forms the basis of the offence.
My worry with that, I assume the reason why it's conduct is because the offences differ in different countries because it's a statutory offence. So I suppose that's why they put conduct. But my feeling would be let's delete the whole section because it double jeopardy, ultra far, whatever, being charged with the same offence twice, whatever you want to call it, is a recognised principle. So if somebody is charged, they will raise it as a defense, and the court can then look at it on a case-by-case basis that, yes, you were actually charged and acquitted of trafficking in another country. No, you were actually charged with tax evasion in another country for this thing, so we can charge you here for trafficking because you weren't charged there. Or you murdered one of the people. You got charged with murder in the other country, and you got acquitted, but now we're charging you for trafficking here. But the court then can do it on a case-by-case basis. That's if you exclude the whole section. But my fear of a similar offence is going to be quite difficult as to what is that offence, and is the section worth anything?
Thank you, Chair. Just for what it's worth, these provisions are based largely on, as Louisa said, the sexual offences provisions and also the Rome statute provisions. I'm just wondering that those principles you're talking about, Atrafaki and Convi, are normally looked at in a domestic situation, and I'm just raising the question whether, because it's on an international application, whether we shouldn't be keep it in. But I've got no problem taking it out, because if you have a look at subclause 6, in any event, the institution of a prosecution under these provisions is must be authorised in writing by the NDPP. So I think he or she's going to take care of that. So I have no objection if we do take it out for the reasons that Mr. Dupree has said.
Sub 6, will that power be able to, is it necessary that power should be delegated to provincial, or what one needs to ascertain how many cases one would expect will occur? Is one not going to overburden the NDPP to have to give that written instruction, and should one not also consider delegating that to the provincial directors of public prosecutions? Maybe one can give consideration to that. But it is an international issue, so maybe that's why it's at the national level.
I suppose where we have provisions where only an NDPP, there are other provisions where we have sub-delegated, but this is at an international level. And if you have a look at subclause 4, the designation of the court where the prosecution must take place is also done with the NDPP. I think those go hand in hand, and the NDPP can decide which DPP has jurisdiction to deal or is going to deal with the matters. I think from that perspective, from an administrative perspective, it might be a good idea. Thank you.
And let's proceed with the section.
Thank you, Chair. Just want to refer you to the document with the proposed amendment that we gave you yesterday. Clause 11. Clause 11 deals with factors that must be considered in sentencing, and it lists quite a number of factors that must be taken into account by the court when sentencing a perpetrator. when we've discussed this at a previous briefing with a committee, there was a comment made that all these factors should rather be dealt with in regulations, because the court in any event would be able to take into account aggravating factors, and that we should not list in the clause itself the factors to be taken into account by the court. On the basis of that comment, we have amended clause 11 the way it looks now.
Before any comments, Nana, I welcome you. I wanted to welcome you earlier. When I had an opportunity, you were already out for a while.
Thank you very much, Shabitha, and I'm sorry for coming late.
Okay.
We had a special caucus of the party. You know, turbulent times.
All right, Honorable Clark, your hand is up. After your visitor.
Sir, I'm just looking for the proposal. Is it on which document? Yes, okay. Just whilst I'm fully appreciative that the issue of sentencing is in the court's domain, and we have the accepted practice of victim impact statements that are made by the MPA. What we need to consider is, by putting it into the body of the Act, the legislature is giving consideration and guidance to the court and saying, we consider this very serious. It's almost similar to the concept behind minimum sentencing. And therefore, we would like you to particularly consider this, and we're not just putting it somewhere. So I'm not saying it has to stay there, but it does, by putting it here, it does give an indication from the legislature side that there are certain factors, and that this is a particularly heinous form of crime, particularly where the sub A to H are involved, dependents producing substances. So I'm not necessarily married to it, but I think we need to seriously consider before we agree to put it in regulations. Thank you, Chair.
I don't know who raised the thing that it should be in regulations. I hope it wasn't me. Was it me? Look, I have the right to change my mind. No. Looking at the sentences being given, I don't think it should be. So I'm sorry if I did suggest it, but I want to backtrack and withdraw that. I think it is useful to put these factors down. And I see then from the submissions there was two additional factors which I think were being with sympathy with. The one was the relationship between the victims, and the person found guilty. The other was about the whether the person is disabled. On the disabled, you said that you wanted to check. I suppose the issue would be disabled people are generally more vulnerable. I'm not sure about that. Because you could have a mentally disabled person who is really taken advantage of in trafficking, or you could have somebody whose disability is not of such a nature that it's relevant. Maybe relevant disability. But definitely I think the issue of the relationship between the complainant victim and the person found guilty should go in, and unfortunately if I did, I'm sorry. I want to change my position on deleting it.
There's no harm in changing your mind. They usually say a clever person changes his mind.
My chairperson unfortunately was not present when this matter was discussed, and I had this question in my mind as I was reading this, that is it really necessary to be here? And because I know that the intention of this law is to show the opposition that the state has towards this kind of crime. And therefore, it must be clear that we're tough in dealing with it. I thought that courts would be in a position to use their own discretion, as they usually do in imposing sentences or fines. And also, without appearing to be on the side of the perpetrators, in my understanding, when a case is dealt with, you do look at the conduct of the perpetrator of the crime, but at the same time, you do look at aggravating factors and also mitigating factors. So I'm not sure whether in the normal course of events when a law is made that is defining a crime, whether there's ever any consideration of things like mitigating factors, seeing that they are aggravating factors. But I do recall that when sentences to be passed, both mitigating and aggravating factors are taken into account. I'm just having in my mind, having sort of frustrated as to both in terms of the making of these criminal, what you call, cases and also practice as to how proper or fair, if you like, is it for such a clause to be in a law, which takes only one side and not taking into account the other, which is, I say, mitigating factors. If we're talking about aggravating factors, the court will look at the mitigating factors when it has to pass on them. But like I say, I was not here when JJ was suggesting that it may be put in under regulation rather than here.
Can I say something before they ask?
I hear what my colleague says, and clearly the courts will consider both aggravating and mitigating circumstances. But we have, over the years, we have in other legislation put in specifically aggravating circumstances. From to give an indication, I think if one takes back to the minimum sentencing legislation, where we gave clear guidelines to the courts, and even the Child Justice Act, where we said it would be an aggravating circumstance for an adult to use a child in an offence, given an indication that there are circumstances which indicate the legislature's sentiment concerning the seriousness of an offence. So it's not the first time that one does put in legislation where the legislature gives an indication that aggravating circumstances should be considered. We can't bind the courts. Clearly, they will consider both aggravating and mitigating circumstances, but we can give an indication from the legislature's perspectives as to what our sentiment is, and that was the whole background to the minimum sentencing legislation.
Maybe it's something the solution would be we put it in as an option, and we can resolve it later rather than trying to resolve it now. But I think the issue was to indicate the serious factors that should be taken into account. Obviously, the mitigating factors can be raised. But what's concerning me, and the NPA need to give us the proper input, is the sentences being given for trafficking. I mean, I'm just looking at this one State versus Eloff and Godfrey of Velcom case. Keeping a brothel, 5 years, totally suspended. Engaging sexual services, 12 years, suspended for 5 years. Procurement, 12 years, suspended for 5 years. Assault, 2.5 years, suspended for 3 years. Living off the earnings of prostitution, 8 years, suspended for 5 years. Money laundering, 5 years, suspended for 5 years. And then trafficking, 16 years. Imprisonment, suspended for 5 years. The whole thing suspended. I mean, they seem to have then ended up with correctional supervision for something. But that's basically all. And that seems to be quite a serious case. And it just seems as though the courts are not actually... I mean, they seem to be basically fining people and giving suspended sentences rather than sending anyone to jail. And I think the aim then would be... I mean, look, we've got to look at the whole sentencing regime. Do we have minimum sentences? Which is a big question. If we don't, I would think then we'd very definitely need something like this.
I saw your hand up, Mr. Tissot.
Thank you, Chair.
Chair, I think most of the issues that I was going to raise have been raised. Just to add, this is also a new type of offence, and that might be another reason why we should be giving the court some guidance, but Ms. Nolimiso's concerns, or not concerns, but observations are valid, but it's against those for those reasons.
Sorry, Chair, and just to add to that also, what we did when we drafted this, we also said that, but not limited to, but because, as Mr. Bassett said, it's a new offence, we wanted to give guidelines to the court, and because what the Honourable JJ also, sorry, has spoken about this, you find in certain offences, the consistency with regard to sentencing and things like that differs broadly. So when we provide with these guidelines, we're not merely limiting the court to look at this. We're drafting this. We consider the independence of the judiciary with the legislature. And we find that this is in accordance with the Constitution to provide the guidelines, but we're not limiting the courts to this. The courts can go over and above this, but these are basically just to provide primary guidelines for the courts so that they can come with more consistency when imposing sentencing.
So maybe Ms. Steeman can help us here. We might be, the protocol might have also said something about that, and I can't remember sort of telling us that we must do something along these lines.
I'm still looking at that, Ms. Steeman. Can I just say, Ms. Williams, I don't blame you. We affectionately called Honorable Jeffrey J.J. for so long. I once chaired a committee on civil jurisdiction. I struggled for the whole day to say Jeffrey. I ended up saying Jefferson. He corrected me now and again, but it took me some time until I managed to say Jeffrey.
Thank you, Chair. I actually just want to mention, after having listened to all the comments made, that we have discussed Clause 11 with the NPA, and I feel quite strong about the fact that we should list the aggravating factors in the clause itself and not in the regulations. Just to proceed on Clause 11, just something that was pointed out to me by my colleague. The goal, apart from the offences created in Chapter 3 of the Bill, in several of the other clauses, there's an obligation on persons to report cases of trafficking, and if they do not, they commit an offence. But if you look at Clause 11, it states, if a person is convicted of any offence under this Act, so perhaps one should limit this to the offences in Chapter 3 in order to exclude those offences where people, for example, a social worker has an obligation to report a case of trafficking. Going over to Clause 12, Clause 12 deals with the reporting and the referral of child victims of trafficking respectively. You will see in sub-clause 12.1, we have placed an obligation on several categories of professionals to report cases of child trafficking to a police official for investigation. And then in subsection 2, we've also placed an obligation on any other person who on reasonable grounds suspects that a child is a victim of trafficking to report that suspicion to a police official. Just keep in mind that when we come to Clause 13, there's a difference between Clause 12 and Clause 13, because in terms of Clause 12, when it comes to children, there's a general obligation on the public to report cases of trafficking. But with regard to adults, there's no such general obligation. Subclause 3 basically just provides that if the person in either 1 or 2 reports a case of child trafficking, that person must provide reasons to a police official. And if that report was made in good faith, That person will not be liable for any civil action on the basis of the report, and that person will be entitled to have his or her identity kept confidential if his or her safety is at risk as a result of the report, unless the interests of justice require otherwise. Subclause 4 states that a police official to whom a report has been made, or a police official who on reasonable grounds suspects that a child is a victim of trafficking, must within 24 hours refer their child either to a designated child protection organization or the provincial Department of Social Development. And a child will then be dealt with, so referred will then be dealt with in terms of the Children's Act, and all the protective measures as contained in the Children's Act will be applicable to all child victims of trafficking. We had some bit of a discussion with the police on this clause. They had some concerns, and I will highlight the majority of their concerns when we come to clause 13. Just with regard to clause 12, one of the suggestions that they made was that we should also include the psychologist. And the department do not have any objection against including a psychologist. I'm just actually looking whether we have any other submissions on this clause. That's basically the position on clause 12.
Open for the committee. Honourable Jeffrey.
Psychologist should be included. I just remember a case where, in fact, there was a friend of mine who was a psychologist, reported the stepfather was counselling a child and felt the child was being abused, and then reported it to the police, and the person that was being accused was then sued her. Eventually lost. But that also brings it on to the case of, so you include psychologists and they have their own codes and things, but are you protecting any of these people from civil liability? Placing a requirement on them to report it, and it has to be done in good faith, but let's say they do it in good faith and it's not correct. Are you protecting them from... in good faith is not liable to civil action. Sorry, okay, I see it, okay. Yeah, okay, that's covered. So the only point I'd make is include psychologist. I was going to ask, is a psychologist a social professional, social service professional, but yeah.
Thanks, Shepherdson. Shepherdson, without really trying to cast aspersions on the South African Police Service, they are doing a wonderful job. But, you know, there is a piece of legislation whom I think credit should be given to this House. This legislation that deals with abuse of women and children. In it, there is a clause which really provides a safeguard in an event that a police officer in a police station in which the matter has been reported is held liable if a case is reported to him and he hasn't handled it properly. You know, sometimes our police can be jittery in handling cases. I was wondering, Shepherdson, given the seriousness of the bill and the nature of the matter we're dealing with, I would imagine I'm thinking on top of my head if the department would consider including such deals in the bill, particularly as it relates to the police.
Yeah. Thank you very much. I'm being influenced by the idea of including a psychologist. Now, this makes me think that we could also include a criminologist. as well as a penologist. These are people who actually specialize in the issue of punishment and in the understanding of why this particular person has committed this particular crime. I'm saying this because I worked at UNISA in the same department, and we used to be called from time to time as penologists and as criminologists. So let me be a bonus. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I don't know all these others. The professor obviously specializes in that. I just want to comment on the SAPS issue. I mean, I don't think that putting things in legislation is going to change the situation. The reason why the police don't do what they're meant to do is because of management in the police and oversight of the police. Because the Domestic Violence Act, they've got provisions already in there, and they're quite strong, and they're supposed to have complied with them for the last 10 years, and they still haven't. And we recently just, when I was on the committee before, have just now approved this new ICT legislation as a secretariat legislation, which is designed to oversee that far better and make the police more accountable. And I think it's not going to really help making more obligations on the police. I mean, they are obliged to comply with the law anyway, and they still don't with domestic violence. You go to any police station, they don't have the registers, they don't have half the stuff they're supposed to have. So it doesn't really help necessarily putting more stringent things in the law if they aren't complying with the existing law anyway. So I think we need to just make sure that, you know, that they are, and keep on putting pressure on the police to enforce what they're supposed to be doing.
Chairperson, thank you very much. I'm looking at subclause 1 and 2, and I'm trying to establish what is the difference between 1 and 2, and I can't quite make it out. But I understand that maybe it's because some of these people mentioned by name there is because of the kind of what they do. And I ask myself, is the list exhaustive? What about the public civil servants who would in a position to be exposed to this kind of thing? Generally, not necessarily those connected to the particular department. Just civil, ordinary civil servants, like in home affairs, where the person, perhaps the victim might report that her passport or identity document has been stolen or tampered with. What about local councillors who deal with the public? What about politicians, like MPs and others? Why are we listing only those and leaving out others? If we're saying close 2 covers the others, then I don't quite understand why do we have one. We have one and then list everybody who is in this sort of the same class as in terms of their areas of operation as the others. And one other legal question, what's the difference between a traditional health practitioner and a traditional healer? Thank you.
Honorable, as far as I can see, the difference between 1 and 2 is that the people listed in 1 are bound by another law, policy, or code of conduct which prohibits them from disclosing personal information. So the question then really is everybody that's listed there bound by some other law, code of conduct, or code of policy or code of conduct? And if they're not, then they shouldn't be there because they would fall under 2. So it would deal specifically with medical practitioners where they are, the issue of confidentiality. I know with psychologists that they are have to keep their clients' information confidential. So it's but I don't know about the immigration officer, the labor inspector. Presumably there might be a similar thing on the social worker, nurses. I don't know if they're bound by that. Maybe they are. But that's basically the difference. Is everybody in 1 should be have another law, policy or code which promotes confidentiality, and this excuses them, and then. 2 is everybody who's not covered. It may not be the best way of dealing with it. But look, I think that
what is it, subclause 4, regarding the issue of the police, a person who fails to comply with the provisions of 1, 2, or 4, so it's clause 6, and 4 is the one about the police officer, and I should just take it up. It's specifically created as an offence. Domestic Violence Act is now under the Civilian Peace Secretariat. The harassment bill is likely also to go there in terms of harassment orders. I don't think we should make everything go that way, because that was more where people approached the court for protection orders from harassment or from domestic violence, and you need the police to investigate. In a case where it gets reported to the police that there might be trafficking going on, it's been criminalized if they don't take it up. But I don't think that if you start saying other people must monitor it, like the Civilian Secretariat, then they're just going to be spending their whole time monitoring these things. And why trafficking? Why not any other crime for that matter? The reason domestic violence and the possibility of harassment was because that relates to protection orders.
Thank you, Chair. The Honourable Jeffrey already explained why the difference between Clause 1 and 2, so I'm not going to go into that.
Instead of having the list, why don't we have names of people? Why don't we say any person who is bound to confidentiality due to any law, policy, or code of conduct, and who picks it up in the course of their duties. So we instead of trying to list all these people, we specify that it is people who are subject to confidentiality in terms of a law, code, or policy. What about dealing with it that way? And then you make the distinction quite clear between A and B, 1 and 2 rather.
Just for the sake of clarity and so that we can go back with a common understanding, can you just repeat what you just said?
What I was going to say is the difference between 1 and 2 is 1 applies to people who are bound to confidentiality in terms of a law, policy, or code of conduct from reporting what they see when they maybe interview victims or people associated with victims. So a social worker going to visit a trafficked woman is not meant to report it in terms of a psychologist, rather, or a doctor or something. So one exempts them. My suggestion then is rather than trying to list all these people, some of whom may or may not be bound by this confidentiality, why don't we make it general that any person, because you've got the issue, lawyers are bound by confidentiality too, they're not here. Maybe that's because it's unlikely that a lawyer will have a trafficked victim as a client or whatever, I don't know. But why shouldn't they be there? So instead of listing, trying to have a comprehensive list, you simply say any person who uncovers trafficking or on reasonable grounds suspects that is bound by a law, policy, or code of conduct prohibiting the disclosure of personal information. So you don't list the people. Are you following me then? Yeah.
Yes,
that's the distinction between 1 and 2. So 1 applies to people who need exemption from the law, policy, or code of conduct which prohibits the disclosure of personal information. 2 is everybody else who's not subject to that law.
I actually think it's a great idea because we were constantly faced with questions as to why didn't you include this professional, why not including this, for example, including a criminologist. So if you actually have such a general provision where you don't specifically list them, then you don't run the risk of actually excluding some that should be included.
I also think that it's a good idea that Mr. Jeffrey raised the possibility and raised why a lawyer isn't here. I think a lawyer maybe shouldn't be here. We could debate that. And then if we do go that route, lawyers are subject to codes. I'm just worried from that point of view.
Every lawyer will be covered.
It's the same question of why. Look, I think it's unlikely that a lawyer is going to get that.
I mean, it's attorney-client privilege, basically. But so I think it's very unlikely that they will get access to this information. I mean, a traffic victim is unlikely to be consulting a lawyer. A witness, they're not bound by the attorney-client privilege, it's only their clients. But why do you think they shouldn't be covered? Chances then of an attorney having a client who's a trafficked victim and therefore bound by that privilege is really very, very, very unlikely.
The same argument applies to doctors, actually, because they're also bound by confidentiality. So there's no real, I mean, whilst I support fully the attorney-client privilege, you know, if they shouldn't be covered, then neither should the others, really, because they're in the same boat.
It is a very good proposal to provide at any person on reasonable grounds, but the thing is we need to protect the attorney-client privilege. And what happens if you need to defend someone who says they've been charged with trafficking and they maybe do some sort of confession to you or something, or you have something within your personal knowledge? I think you just get the big... I think it would be contravening that attorney-client privilege for an attorney to disclose that information. Because the attorney-client privilege is protected by law in our country, so I think maybe we should be careful for putting attorneys within this. And I think that's also one of the reasons why we deliberately excluded them from subsection 1. Thanks.
And a comment about the traditional health practitioner and the traditional healer?
We were actually requested to, because it seems to me that these terms are being used interchangeably. And during the submissions that we've received actually said that we need to include both these terms in order to make sure that we do not exclude any particular person from this.
Honourable Schaefer, Honourable Jeffrey.
Yeah, I think we need to very carefully consider this thing. It is quite feasible that a person who is involved in trafficking will consult an attorney. I mean, and they could then want to negotiate a deal or something, or plead guilty or a plea bargain or something like that. And I do think I think it would be very wrong to actually include them when I think about it now.
In spite of that, I would still suggest that we do the generic approach of any person, and then we exclude attorneys and probably advocates. Doctors wouldn't be, because the doctor, and the doctor would be examining the person's medical condition, and you want them to actually report that, look, this person who looks as though they've been beaten up or whipped or whatever actually is a traffic victim. And so I think doctors are going to be quite useful. But what I'm then saying is, what about then, rather than trying to list all the people who should be covered, do the general thing of anyone who's bound by a law, policy, or code of conduct prohibiting disclosure, and then we exempt. And obviously, clearly an exemption is then attorneys and advocates. And if we can think of any other ones, we can exempt. Then you don't have the problem that Nkosi has of a traditional health practitioner and a traditional healer.
What is the case of confession is made to them or something like that? Is that relevant at all?
Covered. They're part of this. You can't, unless you exempt them.
Okay.
Sorry, if I can just add, the only reason why we for exempting attorneys or legal professionals, certain legal professionals, is because their confidentiality is governed by law, but there's other professions which confidentiality is governed by code of conduct and not by law itself, and that's why we're providing for them. But attorneys are the only ones whose confidentiality is exempted by law. The others are all through a code of conduct or something with their professional counsel or things like that. Thanks.
Yes, it is. The traditionalitas, how do they come to Fisher? Is it because they also might be given confidential information? And I also asked about politicians. Where do they, local councillors and maybe MPs, wouldn't they be involved in the same way as these other people are?
I'm tempted to say this. It doesn't happen so often that a traditional leader talks on behalf of councillors. I commend Ngozi.
Just to respond to the question of why we included traditional leaders. From the submissions that we've received, people feel that traditional leaders are usually held in high esteem within their communities. And that before people would actually go and report something, they will first go to the traditional leader in order to ask for advice or guidance. So in that context, we have included a traditional leader in here.
And when they fail to do the necessary, they are likely to be penalized like everybody else.
Yes, it's an offense if they do not report.
I'm interested that the parliamentary procedure says that this bill is not necessary to be referred to the House of Traditional Leadership. On this point, they might want to object.
Right, I think, can we proceed with the next clause?
Yes, before we go to the next clause, just another comment made by the police, and this will apply in respect of both clause 12 and clause 13. What I actually said was that if a case is, for example, reported to them, and someone say to them, we are aware of the fact that there's a victim of trafficking being locked in a house or somewhere, so they actually want to have the power to go and actually rescue the victim from the situation. And they've provided us with the provision, and I'm going to read it to you. It reads according to the following lines. A police official to whom a report has been made, or a police official who on reasonable grounds suspect that the child is a victim of trafficking, or it can be an adult, may, without a warrant, enter any premises if he or she on reasonable grounds believe that the safety of that person is at risk and may use such force as may be reasonably necessary to overcome any resistance against entry to the premises, including the breaking of any door or window of such premises, provided that such police official shall first audibly demand admission to the premises and notify the purpose for which he or she seeks to enter such premises. So the suggestion is that we should include the provision along this line in both clauses 12 as well as clause 13.
From the committee members, can I vote back?
The Procedure Act not already enabled the police to do that. Where there's a suspected crime, has been to enter any premises, use the necessary force without a warrant. I'm just asking whether it's really, I'm not opposed to it, but is it not already covered in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act?
Mm-hmm. Because it was that point that, I mean, you can, in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, you can search a place without a warrant, and the one requirement is that in the time it takes you to get the warrant, what you're looking for may have gone, as far as I remember. Now,
that requirement isn't in that police definition. That the in the time, you suspect that there are trafficked people in a building, you then go and break down the door and shoot everybody up and have a look and see if they're there. Whereas this element would be that you'd have to have reasonable grounds to believe that they're going to be removed. That's why you've got to go running off and you can't get the warrant from the magistrate. So I'm worried that isn't covered and should be covered. I mean, I think let's see the wording. I think basically, and let's see the section from the Criminal Procedure Act. I don't have a problem for ease of reading for police for a clause largely repeating what is in the Criminal Procedure Act being in this bill, so police know that, okay, they can do it. But I do think this requirement of a belief that the victims will be moved or harmed in the time it takes to get the warrant, a search warrant, should be provided for, just to limit it, as is done with searches without warrants anyway.
Thank you. This came at the last moment. We would like to have a look at it, and I can't remember when Ms. Freeman was reading it, but I think in the Criminal Procedure Act there's also a distinction between premises and private dwellings, I'm not too sure whether this relates to a private dwelling. If my memory serves me correctly, policemen can only enter a private dwelling in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act with permission of the owner. But I'm speaking of the corrections, but I think I do make a distinction in the Criminal Procedure.
All right. Ms. Stefano, can you proceed?
I would like to take you now to the document that we provided you with yesterday, looking at Clause 13. Clause 13 deals with the reporting and the referral of adult victims of trafficking. Once again, in subclause A, we've identified a list of people who must report cases, but we will also look at that in the context of what was just suggested in respect of Clause 12. You will also see that Clause 13 requires written consent of the victim of trafficking to be given in order for, if you look at subparagraph B, if a social worker, a social service professional, a medical practitioner, nurse, traditional health practitioner, healer, or traditional leader, those people may only report a matter to a police official provided that they have obtained the written consent of the victim. And the reason why the requirement for written consent has been included here was because the people listed in paragraph B are bound by certain codes of ethics, certain codes of conduct. But with regard to this provision, I think there were a lot of objection received from the inclusion for the inclusion of written consent, and people quite strongly felt that we should delete the requirement for written consent. And once again, one should also look at this provision in light of what was suggested in terms of Clause 12. If you go over to subclause 2, you will see that we have the provision, any other person may report cases of trafficking in persons. And I'm not really sure how necessary is it to include this provision, because whether we have this provision here or not, any other person would be able to report a case of trafficking. Clause 3, similar to what is provided for in Clause 12, also just provides that the person who makes the report must give reasons. Also, what you do is, excluding the person from civil liability if the report is made in good faith. And also that if that person that makes the report, that person is entitled to have his or her identity kept confidential. You will see in subclause 4, dealing with what a police official should do once a case has been reported to him or her, or where he or she suspects that an adult person is a victim of trafficking, we have also made reference there to Section 9.2, and you will remember that the proposed amendment in Section 9.2 was that a carrier who suspects that a person is a victim of trafficking must also report that suspicion to a police official. So the same procedure provided for in Clause 4 will also then apply in respect of carriers. In terms of subclause 5, a carrier can, a victim of trafficking must then be referred to an accredited organization or the provincial department of social development within 24 hours and when necessary with the assistance of the South African Police Service to ensure the safety of the person concerned if the person's safety is at risk. And the victim must then be assessed in the prescribed manner. Just with regard to the reporting obligation here, once a report is made to a police official, that police official must then refer that victim. This is one of the clauses that we've had discussions with the police on, and the police actually feel that we should delete the word refer and replace it with the word notify. And my concern is actually, what if you have a victim, whether it's an adult or a child victim, who is so traumatized at the police station, are you actually going to expect that victim to find his or her way to a police, to an accredited organization or a child protection organization? And I also think that perhaps the word refer used in this bill is not correct, and that we should cater for certain instances where the police official must actually take that victim to a designated child protection organization or to an accredited organization, especially if the victim's safety might be at risk. Are you going to expect that victim to actually go on his or her own to such an organization? Going to subclause six provides that an adult person may temporarily be accommodated at an accredited organization pending a decision to determine whether he or she is a victim of trafficking. Subclause 7 initially provided that once the victim has been assessed and found to be a victim of trafficking, that victim should be issued with a certificate certifying him or her to be a victim of trafficking. And people felt that this that would have stigmatized victims, and that we should not use a certificate or certifying victims of trafficking. And on the basis of that, we have included that victims should be provided with a formal written recognition stating that he or she is a victim of trafficking. And we've basically borrowed the wording from the Refugees Act, which also provides that the refugee is entitled to a formal written recognition of refugee status. Then once such a victim has been recognized as a victim of trafficking, he or she must then be informed of the right to apply for a recovery and reflection period. And subclause 8 just makes it an offense for not complying with subsection 1. And subsection 9 also makes it an offense for not complying with subsection 1A as well as subsection 1B.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yes. First of all, on the issue of the content, I also had that concern. I mean, we really aren't going to combat trafficking if you're going to get people to have to consent to reporting it, because most of the time, as far as I understand, they are very often intimidated by the person who's doing the trafficking. They feel that they don't have a choice, and they might well not give consent. So I don't see why we differentiate between that and 12, and I think that's a good idea to bring those two in line with each other. They are both, in both instances, the codes of conduct of those professions apply, so I don't really see why you do it in one and not the other. As far as 3C is concerned, we say the person is entitled to have his or her identity kept confidential. I think that is vitally important, but my concern is, what if it isn't? And I don't see, I'm not sure if there is, if you can tell me if there is some kind of offence for people not keeping identities confidential. I presume it would only be by the police when it is reported to them. Because I know the vast majority of police are hardworking and honest, but there are those sometimes who are under the wrong influences. And they can, I mean, I've had a person that I personally know who has a different kind of matter, but they were told, the police told the person that she was accusing of what was in the docket and all the details of it. So could we not maybe create an offence as well in that respect for people who do not keep identities confidential? Then as far as refer is concerned as opposed to notify, I fully agree with the sentiment, but I really am concerned that the police are being obliged to do a whole lot of stuff that they really shouldn't have to do. And they often are in the upper situations now where they are having to transport victims all over the place to different stations, different courts, all that kind of thing. Now they're going to still have to go and transport them to social, whatever, welfare-type organizations or accredited organizations. And I do fully agree that they shouldn't just be left there because they might not be able to get there. But I think we need to look further into the options as to how we can work something more effective to ensure that somebody comes to collect them, or maybe we start making the departments do that. Because that really is their job. Why can't they send somebody? Why can't the accredited organization send somebody, maybe, to the police station? And we could maybe look at something like the police shall ensure that a person is handed over to someone from an accredited organization or something like that. But I'm really concerned about the burden being put on the police, as far as that's concerned. Yeah, I think that's it. Thank you.
Okay, briefly, I have a similar concern about the consent issue, and I think that we've got to remove that. Again, the issue of intimidation, the issue of what happens if the person withdraws their consent at a later stage. It does have implications of hiding a crime. I think what's that word called, compounding a crime, where the crime is hidden or something. Then, just on the issue of an accredited organization, sub 5, I think we broadly had discussed this about whether that organization should assess a person. Who then gives the certificate? Is that a departmental or the formal written recognition? I think there's a concern as to an accredited organization given the formal written recognition. I presume it's a departmental document. But clearly, whilst the organizations do a lot of very good work, they've also got a vested interest in that, and one's got to be very careful about that. I also wanted to just find out about the accommodation, whether what aspect does the Witness Protection Division of the NPA play in this whole situation, where there might not be accommodation, might be a rural area or something. Surely the Witness Protection Services should also come in from the NPA side. Thank you. That's just from my side. Thank you, Chair.
After Honourable Sefke.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to support the idea of not giving the victim a document or a note to identify him or her as a victim. And I'm saying this because, Chair, our past research in the field of victimology and criminology has indicated that if that happens, this is an organized crime, then other traffickers will get angry with that particular victim and might attack him, or he might be exposed to further victimization. So that's my point. point.
This clause is really the start of the whole procedure for the processing and care of trafficked victims. It does link to the issue of numbers, because basically the system seems to be somebody thinks they have detected trafficking, or they might have detected trafficking. They then go to the police. The police then refer them to an accredited organization. And once they've been accredited, they determined to be trafficked, then they're entitled to a whole lot of resources and support. So that's the outline. Now, generally, I would have thought that, it's something, again, I think we should have input on. I mean, I also am worried about the consent. I mean, most people are not going to, in a trafficked situation where they've been abused, etc., are not going to really want to consent. But at the same time, if you put an obligation, let's take a lot of the NGOs that are assisting trafficked women. If you put an obligation on them to report and criminalize them if they don't report, then those women may end up not going to those NGOs. So it's a bit of a vicious circle, and I don't know how one deals with that and how one overcomes that, but that's the problem. So you can say no, and it's then a bit of an anomaly where, okay, only if you're bound by some code, then you have to report, but if you're not, you don't have to report. So there's a contradiction there, and I don't know how we deal with it. Do we say everybody must report it if they see it, as in the case of children? And what do we then say about organizations that maybe help trafficked women, who then may not want to go to, because it'll be reported and so on. I'm not sure why. It did come up, the whole issue of appeals. If you believe you are a trafficked person and the accredited organization doesn't think you are, and you want to appeal, presumably you would appeal to the department. But then what about the other way? A alleged trafficked person goes to an accredited organization who determines that they have been trafficked. The police discover that this person wasn't trafficked. When they were being transported across the border, they were in fact drinking in some other place. There's no provision that I could find for the certificate or the determination to be withdrawn if new facts come to light. Okay, you've said that the accredited organization 5B, without delay in the prescribed manner, assess whether the person concerned is a victim of trafficking. But it's often going to be the police, because remember this thing has to come through the police, that are going to be better off to make that determination. So there's a whole lot of uncertainty, and I think ultimately, if we're only dealing with a small number of trafficked victims a year, do we want to subcontract this out to accredited organizations, to NGOs? And then maybe just the one point on the notification rather than referral. I actually prefer the notification, because the police refer the victim to an organization. So they say, why don't you go to, I don't know, Mall of Songololo or something like that. And the person is sitting in Calvinia, where they're going to find Mall of Songololo. Whereas notify would be the cops that have to notify Mall of Songololo that we've got a suspected trafficked victim here. And I think the organization is then more likely to do something to try and get that person than simply the referral.
Let
maybe Ms. Duman also, I was just thinking that maybe you also comment on the state of mind of a person who's being trafficked. Will that person easily be prepared to sign a consent which may expose him or her to the people who are trafficking that person?
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I mean, we have noted all the concerns raised in respect of the requirement of a written consent. And there's not an easy answer to this. And as was also pointed out, is that you're basically also going to, if you do not have some sort of a middle line, you will also have a situation where some victims of trafficking will be hesitant to actually seek professional help if they know that they will be reported. And you do find cases where victims might be so traumatized at that stage when they are actually found by the professionals as listed in the bill, that they're so afraid of the traffickers that they will not even dare to give written consent. So it's quite difficult because, you know, there's pros and cons on both sides. I think what we will do will be to draft possible options and to place that before you, and then one can actually go through that. Regarding the question on three C, on what do you do if the victim's identity is actually not kept confidential? The bill does not provide for any offence in this regard. If, for example, a police official disclosed the identity of the person who made the report, so we will also look at a possibility of formulating an offence in this regard. With regard to the concern raised by the police, and because I think that the crux of the matter is that the police do not want to be responsible for actually transporting a victim to an accredited organization or a designated child protection organization. And this is one of the issues that we're going to discuss with the Department of Social Development. Whatever way we go, somehow we need to make provision for victims who are traumatized or whose life is at risk, not to actually travel alone, but they must be accompanied, whether that should be by the police or social services. We will have to look into that further. Regarding the assessment of victims of trafficking by accredited organizations, I think the concern there is quite valid. And some of the recommendations, particularly also from the NPA, was that perhaps not to allow an accredited organization to do the assessment, but that the Provincial Department of Social Development should do the assessment. Alternatively, if you will allow an accredited organization to do the assessment, that the Provincial Department of Social Development should have the final say, or should play some sort of a monitoring role. Regarding the issue on witness protection, and to what extent will we be able to make use of placing a victim of trafficking in witness protection if that person's safety is at risk? If one looks at a witness protection act, only a victim who is willing to testify in a court of law will be able to be placed under the victim's protection program is provided for in terms of the Witness Protection Act. There's also the issue of what if a victim was assessed to be a victim of trafficking and has been provided with a formal written recognition, which means that a victim has access to all the services provided for, and if the police afterwards discovered that this person is actually not a victim of trafficking, what do you do? The bill does not provide for that situation, and I think that is perhaps something that we have to look into. I hope I have covered all the questions.
Right. Is everybody happy to his or her questions have been covered? Okay. It has been covered. Honorable Jeffrey.
I mean, I think we then need to see different options on this. But maybe one possible thing on the 13.1A, the balancing between consent and people then being scared to go, and I don't know if this would resolve it. You don't have consent because you're unlikely to actually get it, so it's a bit meaningless. You, however, don't. You allow these people who are bound by to silence to report a matter and protect them from reporting the matter, but you don't criminalize them for not reporting it. The only time you criminalize them for not reporting it is if the victim has requested them to report it. So I don't know if that package would be the solution. So in other words, you're a doctor. You see a traffic victim. The traffic victim says, I've been trafficked, help me. The doctor then has to report it to the police, and if the doctor doesn't, they're liable to criminal penalty. That's scenario one. Scenario two is the doctor is examining this person, they think they've been trafficked. The clause gives them the power to report it to the police without incurring civil liability or being bound by the Hippocratic Oath or whatever. So you leave it up to the doctor to decide. You don't force them to. The doctor can then decide, look, this person is like really scared. If I report it to the police, I might endanger them. Therefore, I'm not going to report it to the police. But you do give them the power to. So I don't know if that scenario would take care of the problem of the consent and if you do away with consent, the victims then might not go to seek help. Where if the victim requests, it has to be done. It's criminal if you don't report it, but otherwise you absolve the person from the law, the codes, whatever, preventing them from reporting and civil liability, but you don't force them to report it. Because the other thing I can sort of see is at the moment there are a number of NGOs who are receiving victims of trafficking and assisting them. Those victims are then, those organizations are not necessarily going to the police because the victims maybe are saying, look, we're scared. If you start saying that organization must report it to the police, then those victims won't go there, those that are scared, and they will be, yeah, so that's what I'm trying to do is balance the thing. Otherwise, you could look at a clause on if the person doesn't have to report it or is absolved from reporting it if they feel there's a real danger to the victim's safety. I don't know, but, yeah.
We'll certainly look at it. I think we just have to go back and play with wording and perhaps come up with possible options for consideration.
Then you can proceed to clause 14.
Collect my thoughts on clause 14. It's still on the document that we gave to you yesterday. Clause 14 provides that a child who is a victim of trafficking must be referred to a designated social worker for investigation in terms of Section 155(2) of the Children's Act. And just on reading this, one of the things that that came to our minds was that if you look at Clause 12 says that a child must be reported to a police official for investigation. So paragraph A actually contradicts what's stated in clause 12, because in clause 12 the child must be reported to a police official. Here we say that a child must be reported to a social worker for investigation. In paragraph B, it states that a child victim of trafficking may, pending an investigation, also be placed in temporary safe care. Sorry, in terms of section 151 of the Children's Act. Sub-clause 2 provides that if after an investigation provided for in subsection 1, and in any legal foreign child is brought before the Children's Court, the court may order that the child be assisted in applying for asylum in terms of the Refugees Act. Sub-clause 3 provides that the finding in terms of section 156 of the Children's Act that an illegal foreign child who is a victim of trafficking is in need of care and protection serves as authorization for allowing the child to remain in the Republic for the duration of the Children's Court order. We have included sub-clause 4, and I'm just going to read it first. An illegal foreign child whom the Children's Court has found to be in need of care and protection must be assisted in applying for temporary residence as provided for in section 18.1 at least 6 months before the Children's Court order, making respect of their child, comes to an end, and if it is possible, and if it's not possible to return the child to his or her country of origin or the country from where he or she has been trafficked. One of the concerns that was raised was that if this child can anyway not return, why not providing for the child to apply for refugee status in terms of the Refugees Act? And if you look at option 2, we have also a subclause 4, which provides that an illegal foreign child whom the Children's Court has found to be in need of care and protection must be assisted in applying for asylum in terms of the Refugees Act at least 6 months before the Children's Court order made in respect of the child comes to an end if it's not possible for the child to be returned to his or country of origin or the country from where he or she has been trafficked. So the one option is the child will be provided with temporary residence status. The second option is that a child will be would be assisted to apply for asylum in terms of the Refugees Act.
Questions by committee. Honorable Schaefer.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. This is a question. Who would have that obligation to assist them? I think maybe we need to clarify that. If it's a place of safety or wherever they're staying, then maybe we should just add that in.
Yeah, I think we will need to make that clear for certainty.
Spend some time and give members some opportunity to see whether there are any issues they want to raise or questions to ask before we can say we proceed.
Just on 14.1 A and B now, I mean, child who's a victim of trafficking must be referred to a social worker and may also be referred to a safe care. Why may? I mean, where else are they going to go?
In terms of the Children's Act, and when we actually discussed this provision, we actually thought of recommending that a whole subsection 1 should be deleted because that's already been provided for in terms of the Children's Act. So if a child victim of trafficking is referred to a designated child protection organization, they will then have to deal with a child in terms of the Children's Act, and the Children's Act already provides for an investigation into the circumstances of the child to see whether the child is in need of care and protection. The Children's Court already provides for the instances where a child must be placed in temporary safe care. So we actually thought that it would not be necessary to refer to SOCPROS 1 here.
If there's an obligation in terms of the Children's Act to ensure that children are put in some kind of safe facility, then I would think it's probably better than to leave this out, because I don't think we should create the option to say that they may be referred to safe care if they're being trafficked. I mean, this doesn't make sense.
What is who is a victim of trafficking mean? I mean, it's there under 15. Well, it's 14. A child who is a victim of trafficking, and it will come later under 15. A foreigner who is a victim of trafficking. My question is, what does who is a victim of trafficking mean? Who has determined that? You've got a certification process, but it's, they're not, or whatever you call it, declaration declared. But this is not a person who's been declared a victim. That would be clear. It's just the person who is a victim. Who's going to determine that? So I would have thought with 14 it would be a child who is suspected of being a victim of trafficking, if you're going to have that. And then there is the whole issue that was brought up in the hearings around the status of and I'm surprised, did you raise it or not? Maybe I've switched off. There are... were a number of provisions on this clause that you were not opposed to, or some you even supporting. Have you put them in the okay, no, I think you put them in there. But anyway, what's a victim of trafficking? Shouldn't 14 be a child who's suspected of being a victim of trafficking if we keep one?
You're quite correct, because here we're still dealing with a case where the child will actually go through the children's court process in order to find a child in need of care and protection. So I think the correct wording will be suspected of to be a victim of trafficking. Can I also just get guidance from the committee between option 1 and option 2? Option 1, dealing with temporary residents, and option 2, rather, applying for refugee status.
Is there a feeling of the committee which option should we go along?
Isn't refugee status more appropriate? I mean, they can't be returned.
No, I'd just like to know what are the practical implications for both. Does it entitle them to more or less right one way or the other? If so, what are they? So on. I think Mrs. Posey would be able to help us with that.
Yeah, as we've also indicated, we've actually got a whole list of issues that we still need to discuss with the respective departments. And this is also one of the clauses that we need to discuss with Home Affairs. So once we have consulted with them, we will be able to give you more clarity on what they should actually, what I actually said we should do in respect of this clause.
Right, but what is the committee's suggestion or preference between option 1 and option 2?
Honourable Jeffries? Keep both options for now, but personally, I mean, if you look at the four that's been put in, under even under the temporary residence,
one of the requirements is that it is not possible to return that child to his or her country of origin, or the country from which he or she has been trafficked. Now, to my mind, that is then in the refugee category, if it's not possible to return them. Whereas if it is possible, then they get returned, and this section doesn't apply. But if it's not possible, it's usually a thing where they would be then starting to be, to qualify for refugee status, and it's a whole different scenario. There's the United Nations governance issues. You can only apply for permanent residence if the Director General, you've been here for 5 years, and the Director General can certify that you're unlikely to be able to go back, that kind of thing. But it does seem, because the difference seems to be, or the test seems to be whether you get temporary residence, whether or not you can return. If you can't return, then surely you're heading off into refugee status. Keep them both for now and check with Home Affairs, I would suggest.
I think the suggestion was that it should also apply in respect of adult victims of trafficking. So we will also look at it. Can I proceed, Chair? Going over to clause 15, I would like to refer you to the bill. Clause 15 provides that a foreigner who is a victim of trafficking is entitled to the same public health care services as those to which the citizens of the republic have access. And if one just look at a submission that we've received on the bill, I just want to get to the relevant page. For example, if you look at page 37 of the submission, in respect of the submission made by Wolofson Walolo and the Olifley Foundation, and they actually suggesting that clause 15 should be broadened to include a whole list of other services that should be provided to victims of trafficking. And I think during our discussions with the committee at an earlier stage, the question was again, if you have all these extra provisions for victims of trafficking, what about other victims of crime? And this is one of those things that we will have to discuss with the Department of Health. And if we're going to include anything in addition to what is already being provided for in clause 15, that will certainly have cost implications. So we will have to go and look at what is already being provided for in our public health care system, and also just keeping cost implications in mind. But we first want to have the benefit of discussing this with the Department of Health.
Just again on this issue that Honourable Jeffrey raised earlier, whether we should put in suspected of being trafficked, but I'm not convinced that we should in fact here because, I mean, I think maybe we need to clarify, is it only once they've received that declaration or whatever you're calling it? Because otherwise anyone can come and say, well, I'm a victim of trafficking. I mean, should it not only be once they've actually been declared that they are a victim of trafficking that they're entitled to these services? Although having said that, you also might need to provide for emergency situations.
Isn't a foreigner or an illegal foreigner entitled to public health care in terms of our constitution? I think they are, in any case. The extent to the additions will obviously also depend on what accredited organizations provide. And what the criteria for accrediting an organization means they must have a safe house and that type of thing. So I again get back to our debate that we had earlier about, as you mentioned, the normal victims of crime. What do they have? Yes, traffic victims are a special category. We've got to be very careful we don't send out the wrong message and give too many additional benefits. You might have people fabricating the fact that they are trafficked. So we just need to have a word of caution there.
Yeah, firstly, I don't think 15 belongs here. 15 is about procedures. I mean, it's entitled Chapter 4, Identification and Protection. I think 15, if it does go in, it should be under Chapter 6, Services to Victims, to Adult Victims of Trafficking. So that's one. Then two, you've got the word citizens. I mean, Mr. Swartz already raised it, but our Constitution doesn't really determine, apart from voting rights, citizenship doesn't, I mean, the socio-economic rights, not limited to citizenship. I'm not sure what the internal controls are. So do illegal immigrants and refugees, if they pitch up at a clinic, are they going to get turned away? So I've got a problem with that. And then also, I see Palermo is that the parties, the states need to consider implementing measures to provide for the physical, psychological, and social recovery of the victims. Consider, not that we have to in terms of Palermo. And I do think that I'm worried about this. We've delegated the decision around whether a person is a victim of trafficking or not to an accredited organization. Then once they're accredited, then you're entitled to a whole lot of resources. And I'm worried there's a lot of potential for abuse. So I think let's put it under 15 and let's look at the other services that come when we get to let's put 15 under 6 and let's look at the other services when we get there.
As you correctly pointed out, an illegal foreigner will anyway have access to public health care services. But the reason why we specifically include it in here is because it was brought to the department's attention that illegal foreigners usually find it difficult to access public health care services. Hence we've included it in here to make it very clear that when it comes to foreign victims of trafficking, that they must be provided with public health care services.
I really don't think that it belongs in the Refugee Act.
No.
You know. So it may be a problem experienced, but it's just weird coming in there.
No. Foreigners are then affected across the board, whether they're victims of trafficking or not, so I agree with that.
We will consider both the possibility of including it in the Refugee Act as well as the Immigration Act. To clause 16, and I want to take you back to the document that we provided you with yesterday. You will see that we have effected some amendments to clause 16. The reason being is that the committee stated that the decision whether or not to prosecute a victim of trafficking for offences committed should lie with a prosecuting authority, and that we should not, through this bill, prohibit the prosecution of a victim of trafficking. And I'm just going to read it to you, to read it with the amendments, and then we can decide as to whether you agree with the wording. First, the heading will read criminal prosecution of victim of trafficking. Subclause 1, when deciding whether to prosecute the child who is found to be a victim of trafficking, after an investigation in terms of Section 110 of the Children's Act, or an adult person who has been certified to be a victim of trafficking, that certified we will bring it in line with the previous recommendation that we make use of a written recognition. Or an adult person who has been certified to be a victim of trafficking in terms of Section 137A, the prosecutor must give due consideration to whether the offence was committed as a direct result of the person's situation as a victim of trafficking. And then we deleted everything that we had there. And going over to subclause 2, if during a criminal prosecution of a child or an adult person, the prosecutor on reasonable grounds suspects that a child or adult person is a victim of trafficking, the prosecutor must apply to the court for a postponement and refer the child to a designated child protection organization or the provincial department of social development for an investigation in terms of Section 110 of the Children's Act, or C, refer that adult person to an accredited organization or the provincial department of social development for an assessment referred to in Section 13.5. Subclause 3, a certificate that an adult person is a victim of trafficking or a finding by children's court that a child is a victim of trafficking serves as ground for the withdrawal of the criminal prosecution or the discharge of the victim of trafficking if the prosecutor concludes that the offence was committed as a direct result of the person's situation as a victim of trafficking. Subclause 4, no criminal prosecution may be instituted against a person referred to in subsection 1 or proceeded with against a person referred to in subsection 2 without the written authorization of the National Director of Public Prosecution.
Yeah, I think there's a vast improvement on the previous formulation because the discretion now vests with the prosecution authority. I'm just not sure whether the authorization should be by the NDPP and not DPP. I think it should be delegated down. And I'm not sure about that word, the situation as a victim of trafficking. Is it a situation? Maybe we can look at a better word as a direct result of the person's situation. That just jars a little bit. Condition, I don't know whether what a suitable word. It might be the suitable word. Position. On 16.1, the previous page. And on sub 3, it comes up a few times. Basically, what you're faced with here is a situation of compulsion, which in any case is a defense, is a complete defense. But one's got to prevent the issue of abuse of that, where you can have a trafficked person that there is anecdotal evidence of trafficked people being used for drug dealing or something like that. And then they say, no, but I did it under compulsion. Where does the onus lie? So I think that it's improved. I need to look at it again to see to what degree there's still a potential for abuse. Is there an obligation then on the prosecutor to withdraw? If the prosecution concludes as a direct result, it's an improvement, Chair. Maybe we just need to see what the implications of it. Thank you.
I don't know in light of the time whether you would like us to proceed with chapter 4.
Can I just ask, in the formulation of 16.1, when deciding whether to prosecute? Now, that's a children's child justice decision. And I'm not sure, is there not a pre-decision there? Is it a decision to prosecute or a decision to divert or a decision to... Does a decision to prosecute exclude the possibility of diversion? I can't remember when we formulated that. So it could be a decision to prosecute or divert or something.
Are we all agreed we adjourn at this point until further notice? Bonani will send us some notices to say when we convene. And thank you very much for participating. Thank you very much, Department.